This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Alan Oser on the 18th of February, year 2002, at approximately 10:15 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and am I pronouncing your name correctly?
It's Oser.
Oser. Mr. Oser is in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Sir, why don't we begin the interview today by discussing a little bit about your early life, and if you would, tell me when and where you were born.
I was born in Paterson, New Jersey, January 21st, 1941.
Okay. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in that part
in
of the country?
New Jersey. We lived in Paterson until I was about four, and then moved to Hawthorne, which is adjoining town. And mm-hmm. so a small town of 20,000, mm-hmm. probably still has around 20,000 right next to Paterson.
Okay. Did that have a very strong impact on your decision to go into the Air Force?
The only thing I can think of is I just remember Memorial Day parades and mm-hmm. things like that, that it was kind of a patriotic town.
Mm-hmm.
And, going into, going to college and then graduating at that time, you knew you had to go into the service because
mm-hmm.
we had the draft. And for some reason, I remember reading a lot of military history as I was growing up. I used to go to the library during a break and just take out a bunch of books on military history. So I was very interested in going into the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to Rutgers, they had required compulsory ROTC,
mm-hmm.
which is not a big deal for me because that's what I wanted to do. So the first 2 years were compulsory, and then I went to advanced ROTC for the second 2 years,
okay.
Junior and senior year.
Okay.
And so when I graduated, this is jumping ahead, but when I graduated, then I was commissioned on graduation day.
Okay.
Second lieutenant in the Air Force.
What, in your readings of military history and I guess maybe some of the history courses you took in school, what drew you to the Air Force versus the other military branches?
I wanted to fly.
Okay.
And Rutgers had Air Force and Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I never was that thrilled with the Navy. So I think, right from the start, I was thinking of the Air Force.
Okay. What other aspects of growing up in New Jersey were interesting or that do you remember? What was it like growing up there? What were the other things you did with your free time, stuff like that?
Boy Scouts.
Okay.
And that was the main thing, the main activity I did, a little bit of sports.
Mm-hmm.
But I developed, it's funny, I didn't develop in sports until I got to Rutgers and then started to play more.
Mm-hmm.
Went out for wrestling and played a lot of handball, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly sandlot stuff in high school. But the Boy Scouts, I always consider saved me. I was an Eagle Scout. Went to Jersey Boys State, and that's probably the only reason I got into college. I came from a town that prided itself on having one of the lowest tax rates in Passaic County. The town's very different than in Colorado and probably in Texas. A lot of small towns in New Jersey, and so a county could have a lot of towns, and so when a town advertised itself as having a low tax rate, it usually meant that the school system suffered. So I was lucky to get into college, and I think the only reason I did is because I was an Eagle Scout.
Okay. Let's see. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Two brothers and a sister.
Okay. Did they join the military as well?
No, they. The sister, no. I mean,
okay.
My older brother, because of health problems, he didn't go in.
Mm-hmm.
And my younger brother, he just avoided it because of they went to the lottery system. He drew a high number. Although he mentioned to me that he would have gone to Canada rather than go in, but he also had some health problems, so asthma. So he probably would have been able to get out of it because of asthma.
Okay.
But he would have gone to Canada rather than go into the military.
Well, although this is a little bit ahead of your Vietnam experience,
yeah.
Why don't we go ahead and talk about that? What did you think when he told you that?
We still have a very close relationship, particularly the three boys.
Mm-hmm.
Our sister lives in Jerusalem, so kind of separated.
Mm-hmm.
But the three boys still have a very close relationship, and I respected him for his views.
Okay.
I had no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way he felt. He felt strongly about it, and I remember discussing it with him. And he was sort of a, I don't know if you'd call him a hippie, but he was sort of in his own lifestyle during the 70s. And, it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, I was very much against the war anyway, so.
At what point was that, about what year?
That we had that discussion, that would have been the early 70s. I think they went to the lottery in the early 70s, and then they got rid of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
by the mid-70s, and I can't remember the exact dates of both of those. But the conversations would have been in the mid-70s.
Okay. What did your parents think about your decision to serve active duty military and about your brother's apparent his personal convictions against the war and going to Canada?
Well, my parents are probably, at the beginning, mm-hmm. you know, when I went into the military, thought it was a great career. Mm-hmm. They liked it. Until they found out I had to go to Southeast Asia.
Okay.
That was when I was in England, and I put this in the mm-hmm. in the written one, mm-hmm. in written interview. The telephone system was kind of primitive in the mid-60s, and I made a collect call from a payphone in Alconbury, England, and at the base, and I remember this very vividly, so this would have been in like August of 1966,
okay.
and I said, I'm going to Southeast Asia. First words out of my father's mouth, can you get out of it?
Wow.
Yeah. You know, it was fine being in the military as long as you didn't have to participate in any kind of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you what your parents, or what your father's experiences were in the military, if any.
None. He, I'm sure, we never discussed this, but I'm mm-hmm. sure he never wanted to go into World War II.
Okay.
Before the war started, he had two children, and then a third one during the war. Sister was born in 43, so with three children,
mm-hmm.
I think the odds of him going in were very slim. Two before the war and one during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in early 41, so I think at that time, if you had one child and then two children, that you didn't have to go in.
Okay. How about other relatives, uncles?
Well, an uncle. I had two uncles that went in, and one... the one I was the closest with later on, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and he commented to me that the war was the best thing that ever happened to him. He served in the Army Air Forces in the Pacific in a support role.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing photographs of him on these islands in the Pacific, and he made that comment because he said it got him out of Hawthorne, New Jersey,
mm.
and when he came back from the Pacific, he got the GI Bill and went to college for 5 years and got his master's at Springfield College and went into coaching and teaching at Wesleyan and then the University of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I saw him at the university, we overlapped a year at the University of Connecticut, and I remember him telling me that World War II is the best thing that ever happened to him.
Well.
The other uncle, I never discussed his war experiences. I know he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he got a Bronze Star.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw combat, whereas the other uncle didn't see combat.
Okay.
I had a distant cousin who served during World War II, a female, and mm-hmm. she was in the, I guess it would be called the WACS,
mm-hmm.
the Women Army Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But that was all stateside.
Okay. Well, let's see. What do you remember... about growing up in that part of the country in the Northeast,
yeah.
with regard to Cold War events.
That's why I think there was patriotism in our town as a reaction to the Cold War.
Uh-huh.
It was a small conservative town in New Jersey, Republican, overwhelmingly Republican town.
Mm-hmm.
Patriotism was real strong. There was one guy who was a retired lieutenant colonel, I think. Maybe major, but I think he was lieutenant colonel. I mean, that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, he was honored and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was sort of the nature of the beast back then. I remember very vividly when Sputnik went off in October
mm-hmm.
of 57,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the traumatic impact it had on the town.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little bit too young to really have a reaction to the Korean War.
Okay.
But you talk about Cold War events. Well, Sputnik was... for the Cold War was similar to the assassination of Kennedy. It had a big impact.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents at all talk with you at all about those types of things? You know, were politics and the Cold War and things like that during the conversation?
No, very little. It's more what I've absorbed at school.
Okay.
And with friends. But parents were of the generation that they didn't talk that much about politics.
Okay. Now,
I'll give you an example.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
It was a strong Republican town, and I came out of that, my initial experience as a Republican.
Okay.
Many years later in life, I found out my father was a Democrat.
Mm.
And I just assumed the family was Republican, hardcore Republican. And
mm-hmm.
I found out later that all along he was a Democrat. The reason I didn't know about it is because the Republicans controlled the town, and he was friends with the Republicans.
Okay.
So he played along with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how about, let's see, other events during the 50s that you might have heard about? The Soviet Union's movement into Hungary, things like that.
Yeah, I followed that very closely. I was in the 50s, mm-hmm. growing up, I was very interested in history.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I became a historian.
Okay.
I work software development now, as
mm-hmm.
they say, to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
But I still teach history on the side, and I've written history. I have a book I've published and articles and things like that. So I was very interested in history,
mm-hmm.
and I remember the Soviet invasion of Hungary. I remember also what was going on, the British, French, and Israeli invasion of Egypt and the Sinai. I followed the events of the Cold War very closely.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why in the 60s, in 64, excuse me, 66, when I went over there,
mm-hmm.
I was a firm believer in, you know, we had to be in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was part of stopping the communists, the domino theory. I absorbed the domino theory during the 50s and
mm-hmm.
believed in it,
mm-hmm.
But believed we had to draw the line. And I can remember before I went over there having a discussion with someone in 66 saying, yeah, we had to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I also can remember some of my English friends, because I played rugby for an English team, saying, you got the bomb, use it, when I was on my way over there.
Really?
Yeah.
And they were talking, of course, about the nuclear
atomic bomb. Yeah,
atomic bomb. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was my last practice with them,
uh-huh.
and I remember it. So it had to be in, I guess, late September, early October of '66. And I went to the practice, and I didn't go to practice, but to say goodbye to them. And so I was kind of running the conditioning part, and,
mm-hmm.
and I remember them saying, one guy in particular, and it's not like anyone argued with him.
Yeah.
He said, "You got the bomb, use it.
Yeah.
Don't mess around." Which is what my feeling was, too.
Okay.
Not necessarily use the bomb, but don't mess around.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, at when you were attending Rutgers,
mm-hmm.
what was the atmosphere on campus like about U.S. government policies and the Cold War, the military,
now,
things like that?
Now, I went to Rutgers. I graduated in 62, so I went from 58 to 62, and then I went directly to a master's program at the University of Connecticut. So the initial college years were 58 to 63. Now, even though three of those years were in the 60s really didn't begin until 1964. That's sort of my historical perspective on the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So my 5 years at college, the initial 5 years at college, were really part of the 50s. Very conservative as far as U.S. policy. I don't remember a single... Well, 63, we weren't involved in Southeast Asia. It wasn't visible, let's put it that way. It was still very much Cold War mentality. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, again, very vividly. So you ask what it was like. It was very conservative as far as defense policy and American attitude toward the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
We had to draw the line against the communists.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For that whole 5 years.
Yes, sir. Okay. What did they focus on in your ROTC training in terms of history and military tactics and strategy, if anything?
Well, we wouldn't have had military tactics and strategy that much. That's more Army stuff. Air Force, more blue suiters. But, again, it was the Soviet threat. It was the importance of the triad, mm-hmm. the Air Force part of it. Being the bombers and the ICBMs, that was the time when the Minuteman was developed,
mm-hmm.
and it was going through its development, and so we talked about that. The history we had in ROTC and the history I had in history
mm-hmm.
was all Cold War and mm-hmm. holding the line.
Mm-hmm. And conventional?
Well,
and
for instance,
a focus on World War II type of operations?
Oh, I see what you mean. I don't remember that.
Okay.
How they would... probably not.
Okay.
Because from an Air Force point of view, we wouldn't have been fighting World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Army did, but not the Air Force. So probably not, but again, I'm just guessing on that.
Okay. And was there any talk at all about the use of the Air Force or the role of the Air Force in unconventional warfare?
Oh, no,
that you
I
remember?
Didn't. No, absolutely no. Okay. I didn't. I wasn't exposed to that until I actually got in the Air Force.
Okay.
And then, you know, by then, Vietnam, you know, I went in 63 and then 64, Vietnam was starting to build up in 64.
Okay.
And then we were talking about unconventional warfare,
right.
Guerrilla warfare, mm-hmm. combination of the two. I think it was back in 64, we mainly called it guerrilla warfare.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, just to clarify, what did your father do and your mother do for a living?
Well, my mother was a homemaker mm-hmm. and raised four kids.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had a small factory in Patterson, which gave us a comfortable living.
Yeah.
It was a manufacturer of fluorescent lighting fixtures with my uncle.
Okay.
So the two of them went into business right after World War II, 1945, 46.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother still has the business. So
okay.
55 years later, it's still in existence.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. But you had no desire to follow in that?
I put down in the written interview that mm-hmm. Having to work there during my vacations was a big incentive to go to college and get out of that environment. That's the last thing I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's see. When you were nearing graduation from Rutgers,
yeah.
what did you hear about Southeast Asia, if anything? What did you
nothing.
Know?
You have to remember that in 1960-61, when people talked about Southeast Asia, it was about Laos, not Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The big issue that Eisenhower and then Kennedy dealt with was Laos and
mm-hmm.
what to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And I never, you know, as I look back on my ROTC days, it was all Europe.
Mm.
The entire focus was on Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't remember anything about Southeast Asia as being an issue, again, until I went in the Air Force. And by
right.
then it was... You know, I go in 63, and by, you know, we're starting a small build-up then, and then 64, a bigger build-up, much right. bigger.
Well, of course, in Laos, there was the unconventional war. That
yeah.
is, the U.S. employed advisors, CIA case officers, the air power that was utilized was, again, unconventional.
You have the T-28s they had, and
uh-huh.
who knows what else.
A lot of close air support, rice drops, ammunition. Resupply, things like
yeah.
that. In terms of what you remembered, was this the kind of war that that the people in your community thought was appropriate for the time? That this was
but,
a total war. This was U.S. supporting.
Yeah. Again, I didn't
inside.
Have. I don't remember any discussion of that until
yeah.
I got into the Air Force, and
okay.
then it wasn't about Laos. It was about South Vietnam and North.
Right.
Well, mainly South Vietnam and
right.
the type of war that was being fought there. So I was in the Air Force. I was out of my community. I was
okay.
out of Rutgers. I was
gotcha.
Out of Fort Thorne, New Jersey.
Okay.
And the Air Force was, in 63, 64, was
yeah.
starting to put emphasis on that type of warfare.
Okay.
So that's
well,
my first exposure to that.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and talk about that. What was it like transitioning from your civilian lifestyle to the Air Force lifestyle in 1963?
It was great. My first assignment was Lowry in Denver. And Denver still is a great city. So I was out in the world, and I was in Colorado, and I learned to ski, and I climbed mountains. And you know, every weekend we had off, and meanwhile going through the intelligence school, which was a good program and manageable program. I mean, it wasn't overly demanding.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you were interested in flying.
Yeah,
was
what
that
happened?
To become a pilot?
Yeah, all 4 years at Rutgers, mm-hmm. I fully intended to be a pilot.
Okay.
And in advanced ROTC, the same thing. And my senior year, we had what was known FIP, Flight Instruction Program. And that was 38 and a half hours in an Aronca 7AC. And I was the first one in my class to solo, the first one to finish the course, the first one to go ahead and get my license, the additional hours necessary to get the license. And probably the first one to say, I don't want to fly. I'm not sure why, but near the end of Rutgers, I decided to go to graduate school for
mm-hmm.
a master's in history.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up to the University of Connecticut. And while I was there, I was thinking that I wanted to probably eventually get a PhD in history, mm-hmm. and that I really would just spend my 3 years in the Air Force and then get out.
Okay.
And pilot was I know for me it would have been 3 years, and I think without going to pilot training, I think pilot training was 5 years mm-hmm. at that time. Although the 3 years would be start after I would finish at Lowry, so since that was 7 months, it would be 3 years and 7 months. So while I was at the University of Connecticut, I wrote a letter to, I say military personnel, but that was in Randolph. I remember writing it to Wright-Patterson, Ohio, probably because I was on a military deferment. Mm-hmm. I was in active reserve status because I had been commissioned, so they had to do something with me, so they made me an active reserve. And so I assumed that I was controlled by someone in Dayton, Ohio. So I wrote to them saying that I didn't want to go into pilot training. And they wrote back saying, okay, you know, give us three choices. So I put down three choices. And the second one, I believe, was intelligence, and that's what they gave me. The first one was like education and training officer. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I didn't want to fly, that I wanted to basically get out and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was in, I would have made that decision late 62, early 63, and I always regretted it.
Hmm.
Not always regretted it. I always thought about it. Did I make the, you know, maybe it's a better way to put it is, did I make the right decision?
Yeah.
And then I got to Thailand, and I was there in 66 and 67, and my main job was briefing and debriefing the combat crews.
Mm-hmm.
We had a reconnaissance unit. So these were the pilots and then navigators who were in the RF-101s and the RF-4Cs, and I would brief them about AAA, SAM, and MIG capabilities, and then when they got back, I would debrief them on what they encountered.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, probably very early in that year, I patted myself on the back and I said, Alan, you made the right decision. That was not what I wanted to do for a living,
mm-hmm.
flying combat. So I had second thoughts until I got over there.
Okay.
And then I decided, you know, that was it.
Yeah.
I did keep up, at least for a while, I did do, you know, civilian flying since I had my license.
Okay.
In a Cessna 150 and a Cessna 172.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately quit that, too.
Okay. Now, when you started going through the intelligence course, that you did all your initial Air Force training at Lowry, is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yes. Well, yes and no. You know, since I was in ROTC, we had a summer, 3 week summer camp, and I went to Otis Air Force Base in Cape Cod. So I had those 3 weeks. And then when I was commissioned, and I went to graduate school, and then I came in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So then all my military, introductory military training was at Lowry.
Okay. How long was that training at Lowry?
That was, the training itself went from July to January.
Okay.
And then, because of my follow-on assignment, I was kept there till March.
Okay. Until March of 64?
Yeah.
What was it like when, in November, when Kennedy was assassinated?
I mean, it's one of those things, I remember exactly where I was,
mm-hmm.
and I was at the Lowry Officers Club. It was lunchtime.
Okay.
And all of a sudden they started playing what I would call religious music through the PA system, and we're all going, what's going on here? And then they switched, well, that was a radio station they had on. And then it switched to the news, and it was quite a shock. I do remember that, and I do remember it was a shock.
What do you remember thinking that about that? You know, what went through your mind, and what did you all discuss there about?
We just assumed it was a crazy.
Yeah.
There was, we didn't think in terms of any kind of conspiracy, or still don't think in terms of any kind of conspiracy. I tend to ignore all those
mm-hmm.
books and movies and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was our discussion, is that, you know, someone, probably a crazy one, had assassinated the president.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see it as anything fearful. We figured, you know, Johnson would become president, you know, life would go on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No concern about the change in leadership, the effect that might have on U.S. policy in Southeast Asia or elsewhere?
No. Again, you know, we're talking November of 63.
Yeah.
I did not think in terms of Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Southeast Asia still didn't exist, really. It wasn't until 64 that I'd say that it existed.
Okay. Now, what was the emphasis of the training at Lowry?
It was on it was a combined school, air and photo intelligence, and it was also, they were integrating it. You know, we had Navy in our program too, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think back. Yeah, the emphasis was really on photo interpretation. That this is before satellites, that
yes.
U-2s or other special aircraft, like mm-hmm. eventually I got to the RB-66 and then the RF-4C.
Mm-hmm.
They would fly over the targets, or they'd fly down roads, and that we would have to interpret the photography,
mm-hmm.
Both what's there and what was damaged.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the emphasis for those 7 months, was on photo interpretation.
Okay.
I mean, we were exposed to what I would call operational intelligence, which is enemy capabilities, the MiG, the SAM, the AAA.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember mainly it was photo interpretation.
Okay.
So, for instance, we went down to what was known as CFNI, Colorado Fuel and Iron, or it was the big steel plant in Pueblo, Colorado, mm-hmm. to kind of analyze it from the ground, and we look at photography.
Mm.
So it was a combination of that.
Okay. What do you remember thinking in terms of the capability that we had at the time, in terms of the photo reconnaissance capability? The aircraft we were using, the film, things like that.
Well, we were all impressed with the U-2. When I,
uh-huh.
when the class ended in January, and remember, I stayed around for a couple more months.
Yes, sir.
What they did is they gave us a job to do, and U-2s had been flying over China, mainly along the coastal area, and then with its side-looking camera,
mm-hmm.
it was projecting itself into the interior a little bit. And
mm-hmm.
what we were doing is. We had the photo machines, and we were looking at it and analyzing that photography. So it did look pretty impressive, the U-2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Europe, by the time we had stopped using the U-2 over the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, as a result of what happened, Gary Francis Powell being shot down in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I knew was U-2 photography, and that looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about the U-2 and how impressive it was.
Right. Did you
now
ever,
when I got to Germany,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it was a little bit more jaundiced view
mm.
because you know we had the RB-66, and what was supposed to happen is that as tension built up, and then even when you got to a conventional war, the conventional war was always supposed to precede the nuclear war. Our RB-66s would run down an autobahn in Germany. With the cameras going, you know, picking up Soviet activity
mm-hmm.
and Warsaw Pact activity.
Mm-hmm.
And we could kind of, I remember thinking that, you know, that's not very probable that the Soviets are going to allow these lumbering airplanes, the RB-66, to go down these autobahns taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So
if they can shoot down a U-2,
yeah.
they could probably take out the RB-66.
Right. So I always wondered about that, and then,
yep.
and then you know, here you have this conventional war going on, and
mm-hmm.
we got the photography, and we come back, and I worked both air and then photo intelligence when I was at Alconbury.
Okay.
And then I'd be analyzing the photography. I have the results, and I'd pick up a landline phone,
mm-hmm.
and I'd call down the 3rd Air Force outside of London at Ruislip,
mm-hmm.
and report on what I had seen.
Okay.
I mean, the odds of the phone being operational, I thought, were slim.
Okay.
So I always wondered about that.
Mm-hmm. Would you please explain the difference between the two, air versus photo reconnaissance?
Yeah, again, we're talking about an intelligence officer.
Mm-hmm.
So the primary missions in a tactical unit, one is, an air intelligence is basically what I did in Thailand, and that is, you know, what are the enemy capabilities?
Mm-hmm.
What do they have out there that could shoot us down?
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, in Thailand, I was briefing and debriefing. I was telling them, you know, air intelligence, this is what they had. This is what they could do to you, and then when they came back, you know, okay, what did you encounter? You encountered AAA where, you encountered SAMs where, you encountered a MiG where, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Photo intelligence is just it, you know, looking at the photography.
Right.
So when I was in England for 2.5 years, half of it I was air intelligence, and then I went down to photo intelligence,
okay.
one of the squadrons, and we had a section there, and then we'd run exercises and bring in the photography, and we'd analyze it and then report on what we had seen.
Mm-hmm. Now, did that not involve aspects of your air intelligence roles and missions. That is, of course, in some photo interpretation, you probably would run across potentially mobile SAMs that are moved around.
And that would be true. That was true in Europe, but of course we weren't flying over Eastern Europe, but we were flying simulations over Western Europe. And so that's true. That would be it. But in Southeast Asia, it was different. The SAMs, I don't remember. You know, I hadn't thought of this. I don't remember mobile SAM sites.
Okay.
I remember them being fixed.
Okay.
They had the SA-2. That was the main one, the SA-2. And I don't think the SA-2 was mobile. It had to be in a fixed site with the Fansong radar and tightly controlled. So I don't think they had that over there.
Okay.
But again, I wasn't looking at the photography.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, the AAA could be moved around.
Yes.
Obviously. That was different.
Okay. And what about other, I guess you could call them strategic aspects of photo interpretation, that is factory capabilities, battle damage assessments, things like that?
That was what we didn't have to do that
in
Europe, mainly because we didn't have any. No one blew up a factory for us that we can analyze it. So we were really, when I did photo interpretation, it was more for what we saw on the road. And so we were flying over U.S. Army maneuver areas, so we would report on tanks and things like that.
In
Thailand, that was different because, you know, when I was there, we went against a Thai Nguyen Iron and Steel factory. And I remember looking at the photography. I mean, it wasn't my job to analyze it, but I remember looking at it because it was the biggest target we had ever flown against. And they caused a lot of damage. And somewhere, buried in a box somewhere, I think I actually have a couple of shots of that, of the damage there.
So in your training there at Lowry, did that involve doing battle damage assessments?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if they may have used, and I don't remember this, I'm just second-guessing, they might have used World War II photography to help us with that.
Okay.
That's possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the school, what did they talk about with regard to the Second World War, and in particular, the effectiveness of air power? Of course, because after World War II, they did the bombing survey.
Yeah.
And that was a very
mixed.
Controversial study. So how did they cover that?
Well, the bombing survey was really presented mixed conclusions.
Right.
And people, historians today, go back to it and they form whatever conclusion they want very easily.
Yeah.
I have read articles where historian A says the bombing survey proves conclusively that the bombing campaign was successful, and then another historian B says it proves conclusively it wasn't successful.
Right.
Another one that says it proves conclusively we should have used the atomic bomb on Japan, and another one that says exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
We didn't get into details about the bombing survey. The assumption at Lowry was that the bombing campaign of World War II was successful, because that was the assumption of American life. It wasn't until later in the 60s that assumption was challenged historically, that people started writing about it and saying, well, maybe it wasn't so successful.
Okay. Now you say the assumption is that it was successful.
Yeah.
Was the strategic bombing survey just mentioned, glissaded over?
No, it wouldn't have even been mentioned.
It wasn't even mentioned.
I don't think it would have been.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember coming across it until I started teaching military history at the Air Force Academy.
What year would that have been?
Well, I taught there 9 years, from 67 to 72, and 75 to 80, a 9-year period.
Right. Okay. And let's see.
I'd say 75 to 80. It really was January 76 to 80, to the summer of 80.
Okay. Now, of course, what we've talked about so far in terms of photo intelligence or photo interpretation and air intelligence it's focused on the sophisticated, you know, weapons threats, that is AAA, SAMs, things like that.
Yeah.
What about unconventional threats that the Air Force pilots might come up against in, say, an unconventional war? That is, you're not necessarily going to always run into a threat that's as sophisticated as our systems. Was there any discussion about that in the terms of what the U.S. would be up against in a guerrilla war? You mentioned this guerrilla warfare was finally mentioned there.
You mean that Lowry and all? You're talking about the intelligence school training?
Yes, sir. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
And early on. Mm-hmm. Now, it was never presented as a threat for the Air Force. It was always presented as a threat for the Army, because the Air Force, the concept, and this turned out to be relatively true, particularly in South Vietnam, is that the Air Force could have free reign, and the Army is the one that had to fight the war, and they had to deal with the unconventional guerrilla warfare, that the Air Force would do its bombing and whatever else it had to do. And by and large, you know, though a number of airplanes were shot down in South Vietnam, by and large, they were given free reign. It wasn't until near the DMZ that you had SAMs. You never had a MiG threat. Now, you had the 37 millimeters and low-level automatic weapons. You know, that was always a threat to the Air Force. But they could come in and out, and the odds are they would be successful.
Okay.
So it was looked at more of an Army issue on conventional warfare.
Okay. And how did they cover, especially in the context of the air and footer reconnaissance training, how did they cover the use of decoys, basically fooling, the ability to fool?
We just basically talked about it and showed examples. I mean, a wooden tank and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't in an unconventional context, a strictly conventional warfare context.
Right. Okay. Do you think they covered it realistically?
For Europe. I mean, the course was really designed for Europe.
Okay. Good enough. Well, was there anything else that you remember that was interesting and important, for instance, when you got to Southeast Asia, that you learned there at your initial training?
Well, the political decision that was made in 64, the reason I waited around for 2 months at Lowry is because four of us were given the assignment of Saigon.
Mm.
And what we were supposed to do is go through counterinsurgency training, strictly academic, at Maxwell Air Force Base, and that course was 2 weeks long, and then go to report to D.C. and go to Vietnamese language training. And so the four of us all arrived at, we were given 2 months delay, given looking at this U-2 photography from China.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were, I think they called it PRC, photography, the People's Republic of China photography, something like that. And then we arrived at Maxwell, went through the training, and basically the training, and I remember it was win the hearts and minds of the indigenous population. That's what they told us for 2 weeks. So the whole emphasis was on winning over the people, because we were building up and out, and the focus was Southeast Asia. Well, during that course, all four of us were reassigned. Because what I found out later, I actually talked to someone who was at a meeting in the Pentagon, and McNamara said that he wants only, this is again early, this is mid-64, he only wants experienced people sent to Southeast Asia, because they were still thinking in terms of advisors in 64. And since the four of us were all second lieutenants, that our assignment was canceled. So here we are at Maxwell in counterinsurgency school, and they pulled the four of us out. Two of us were sent to Europe, one to Japan, and one to California. So then we had to hang around for a little while longer as they got this straightened out. So I remember working in the library at the counterinsurgency school, just helping out. And then the two of us caught our port call in May of 64, and we were assigned to Lindsay Station in Wiesbaden. When we landed, we were met at the plane by a personnel officer, and I was sent to Alconbury, England, and the other one was sent to Toulouse-Lautrec, France.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how our life was changed. Back then, it took forever for the pay records, personnel records, whole baggage, everything to arrive.
Right.
They used to. I used to go into the give you an idea how antiquated things were, I used to go into the finance office every so often and ask for money.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have my pay records, but they trusted me or something, and they would just give me money. And then finally, when the pay records showed up, they were a few months later, they were able to adjust everything.
Okay.
That's how I got paid.
All right. Well.
So anyway, so we get to. So your question was, anything else leading up to Southeast Asia?
Yeah. Well, actually, now you've opened up a number of other questions for me.
Yeah.
If you don't mind.
Okay. No, sure.
The PRC photographs and the PRC analysis that you did.
Yeah.
Was this an evaluation, an attempt to see how much material, because you mentioned this along the coast, so I'm thinking supplying North Vietnam.
The whole emphasis, and the only thing we really saw mm-hmm. were Chinese airfields.
Mm.
And nothing at all to do with supplying Southeast Asia. It was
okay.
strictly airfields and what they had at the airfields.
Okay.
That's the only thing I remember from looking at, spending hours and hours looking through the photography.
Can you discuss what it was you were looking for or looking at?
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
That's just looking at the airfields, but
yeah.
But why in particular?
Oh, I'm assuming it was just because they were still a threat to Formosa, Taiwan, and the Republic of China. So our main job over there was, the fleet was to protect
mm-hmm.
Formosa.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was the emphasis.
Okay.
I remember in early 64.
Mm-hmm. During your training, how were the countries of the People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union, how were they covered and how were they linked into ideas about what was happening in Southeast Asia, what was happening in South Vietnam in particular?
During the training, it wasn't mentioned.
Was not?
No. Again, we looked at, until I got to counterinsurgency school, obviously,
mm-hmm.
we looked at communism as monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, the Korean War, we assumed it was orchestrated by Stalin. What we've learned since then is that it was orchestrated by Kim Il-sung,
mm-hmm.
and Stalin went along with it, but it wasn't something that he was pushing for.
Right.
I mean, these are things we've found out later, but
right.
at that time, we thought that China and Russia,
mm-hmm.
North Korea, North Vietnam were all one evil empire, to
yes.
use a more contemporary quote. We didn't use that expression back then.
Right.
But we looked at communism as monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
So, the insurgency in South Vietnam was all part of this worldwide communist conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
the domino theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that goes back to Eisenhower, but it was still very much in our minds as we moved into the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you said they didn't talk about that until you got to counterinsurgency training at Maxwell.
Right, and then they talked about the communist threat and
right.
how the guerrillas were communist. And
uh-huh.
I couldn't swear to this,
uh-huh.
but my guess is they didn't spend much time talking about communism because I think that was understood by all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way we looked at the
mm-hmm.
Soviet Empire, is, again, this monolithic empire.
In terms of the counterinsurgency training, that is the idea of winning the hearts and minds of the people.
Right.
Was it the idea at the school that this war in South Vietnam and Southeast Asia would not be won through conventional means, that it would be won through this type of an attitude, this type
yeah.
of mentality?
Yeah, and this was building on what Kennedy had done organizing. I guess he was the one who did the Army Special Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Air Force's job would be to support the Army, mm-hmm. and if you were stationed in that environment, you had to win the hearts and minds of the people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, was there anything?
And we thought we actually were going there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
here we were going to Saigon. That's
right.
the reason we were there.
Right.
And they were sending us to language training. So obviously, our role was to win the hearts and minds of the people.
Okay, so after you finished your counterinsurgency training, they were going to send you to DLI.
Yeah.
To
they had it in Monterey and they had
mm-hmm.
it in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm assuming is that it was maybe contracted out through the State Department or
mm-hmm.
something like that. I mean, I don't remember because we never got there.
Right. And let's see. Well, was there anything else that you recall that was important interesting that you were trained in, whether it be at Lowry or at Maxwell?
No, I think that was it.
Okay.
Yeah. Just trying to think a second. No, that was about it.
Okay. I have two other follow-up questions. Did you, you heard, obviously, you were very much affected by the assassination of President Kennedy, if nothing else, on an emotional level. Did you even hear about the assassination of President Ngo Dinh Diem?
We talked about that.
Okay.
I remember. That's a good question, because that happened earlier in November.
Yes.
And I remember having lengthy discussions about that. So even though our training didn't deal with Vietnam, our discussions did. Because
mm-hmm.
I remember talking about it.
Do you remember what the substance of those conversations was?
Well, just the unknown, what was going to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the newspapers and the magazines, by magazines I mean the weekly news magazines, are pretty well reporting what was going on there. I mean, we knew about the monks burning themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We knew about the Diem's persecution of Buddhists. And we knew about the civil war going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we did discuss it. And, you know, so here this general takes over. Was it Big Ming? Was he the one who took
mm-hmm.
over? Whatever one took
yeah,
over.
Yeah, Big Ming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But again, that was discussion of Vietnam. That was not our course.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in the preparation for becoming advisors eventually in Southeast Asia, before you got your revised orders to Europe, did you do any kind of photo interpretation? And did you see photographic
no.
reconnaissance images of Saigon and Southeast Asia?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I don't remember at all.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we had any.
Okay.
I think the U-2s were flying over more conventional targets.
Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and discuss your first real duty station then, which was, as you said, in Alconbury,
yeah.
England. What was your primary mission, your primary job there, and what did you do?
Well, it really built on the course I had at Lowry, because it was all dealing with the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, the Eastern Bloc. So I started out half the tour, as I said, I was air intelligence officer, mainly the Soviet capabilities with the AAA SAM and MiGs, and also my specialty for that first year and a half was escape and evasion. I went to three courses during that year and a half, so kind of becoming the wing expert on escape and evasion, and then I would brief the different, I'd give briefings to the crews. So I went to the Army had a special E&E course in Germany outside of Ramstein somewhere, so I just remember going to that. I went on an exercise with the Territorial Army, the British Reserves, or Guard, or the equivalent of, they were called the TAs, and that was on a Salisbury plain, again, E&E across the plain, and then I went on a two-week exercise with the Army Special Forces, I think they were the 10th in Europe, and this was in Belgium, and so we've broken up into teams, two people, and then we were, they dropped us off in the middle of nowhere, we were supposed to be down airmen. And then we evaded for a week, and then they picked us up, and then
mm-hmm.
we stayed with them, and eventually they flew us out in a 123, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
On some dirt strip somewhere. So that was for the first year and a half.
Okay.
We had this money, gold coins, and I had that account signed out on my name.
Mm-hmm.
So. These were solid gold coins, like Louis Napoleon's or something like that. I don't
mm-hmm.
know what they were, but they weren't American.
Mm-hmm.
They were European. And so the idea is that when, for the actual combat missions, our air crews would have these gold coins, they'd be signed out to them, and they would take them.
Mm-hmm.
But we never got to that point, so they're just maintained in our top secret vault.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, again, for the first year and a half with the air intelligence, that's what I did. And then I moved down to the squadron. And we had two recce squadrons, and both of them had a photo interpretation section. And I ran the photo interpretation section for one of the squadrons, the first TRS, first Tactical Reconnaissance Squadron. Then we also had the, I say the 30th. Now I might be getting my unit mixed up with the two units in Thailand, but I think they were the 1st and 30th, the 10th Tactical Reconnaissance Wing, which was deactivated in England whenever they started deactivating in the 90s, and they activated it at the Air Force Academy, which is kind of ironic because you know, I go up to the Academy a lot, and there's the 10th, it's not called the 10th TRW Reconnaissance Wing, but the 10th whatever it is wing. And so the Academy officially is under the 10th.
Oh, that's fun.
So I ran a photo interpretation section, and I can't remember how many people we had, maybe 8 to 10. I remember it was me, a relatively senior NCO, and then a number of interpreters, young airmen. And, you know, training all day long, and then the crews would go out every day, and they'd take photography of someplace, and we'd process it. And then they'd have major exercises throughout the course of the year from 3rd Air Force and from USAFE.
Okay.
Those were the important grading cards.
Okay. Now, during your first period, when you were working a lot with escape and evasion, things like that, how much of that training focused on issues of, say, the code of conduct?
The crews, I don't remember it being my responsibility, but the crews were given code of conduct briefings. I very definitely remember that. Name, rank, serial number. That was it. I mean that was it in a nutshell.
Now, was this training, was it built upon the experiences of World War II or Korean War POWs?
Particularly Korea.
Korean War POWs.
Yeah. Because it talked a lot about the difference between World War II and Korea.
Okay.
Where, you know, things did happen in World War II, but Korea is where they very definitely tried to get, well, the word that was used then was, or the phrase was brainwashing.
Brainwashing, yes.
Yeah.
And
you know, World War II, they would try and get some intelligence, but the Korean War was brainwashing.
Okay. Along those lines, in a popular culture question. Did you were you aware at all of the movie when it came out, The Manchurian Candidate?
I saw it when it came out. Do you know the year?
It was, I think, in 64. It was initially slotted for release in 63, but because of the Kennedy assassination, they postponed it.
I remember seeing it, and it dealt with brainwashing of Americans.
In Korea.
Yeah, and they come back, and
yeah,
you know, and then they become an agent.
Right.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. And
okay.
Although I probably thought it was exaggerated, you know, I would have linked it to what was going on in the world.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of preparing pilots for being shot down, potentially being captured, or being pursued by enemy forces behind enemy lines, what lessons do you recall were incorporated from the Korean experience?
One of the main ones that I remember from the specifically from the Korean experience, because one of the guys, a major making the tour of USAFE, he was assigned there, and he had been a POW in the Korean War, and we're only talking about a dozen years later. And one word, patience. And he just, and so one of the, you know, E&E, you're just running through the countryside, and, you know, it's sophisticated Boy Scout work, I guess, you know, how to evade and, you know, camouflage and all that. But the main emphasis is what happens if you're captured. And he just talked about patience, that you got to realize that you could be there a while, which he was. I don't know how many years he was there, but he was captured for a number of years, and he was kept in solitude and beaten and things like that. And it just, I guess it's what our POWs in the Vietnam War learned, is that they have to be patient. I remember that being a big point, and they really listened to him. When he came to the base, they really did focus on what he was saying, because, I mean, here's a guy who had been a POW in the Korean War, and it looked like, again, it's a new ball game. It's if any of our crews had been captured, in Europe, the model wouldn't have been World War II. The model would have been the Korean War,
mm-hmm.
and that was very clear. That it was. That's what I mean by a new ball game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. And you left there in
66, October 66.
Okay. And I'm sorry, but before we talk about your movement to Southeast Asia, the second portion of your time there, that is when you were doing photo reconnaissance,
right.
Photo interpretation.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever come across anything interesting, unusual, that you didn't anticipate?
No, because we were just flying over Western Europe.
Okay.
We were flying mainly over Germany and over U.S. and Belgium, and France was starting to separate at that point, but we had some routes. They would fly routes,
mm-hmm.
Autobahn routes.
Mm-hmm.
And for an exercise, we'd fly against the U.S. Army,
mm.
or whatever, a NATO army.
Yeah.
So there was nothing. We were never looking at real stuff, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a tank is a tank,
yeah.
Whether it's an American or a Soviet.
Right.
Yeah. So if war had broken out, conventional war, and we were flying over East Germany and there were tanks on that road, I mean, we didn't have to know much about tanks.
Right.
If there were 20 tanks on that road, you just had to assume they were Soviet tanks.
Okay.
It wouldn't be American.
Right. Okay. How quickly would that intelligence be incorporated and disseminated so that it could be utilized in a combat context?
The planes would land. The priority was getting the film downloaded.
Mm-hmm.
It was developed. You know, we had it within an hour after the landing, and then we could do it quick and dirty and look at the film.
Uh-huh.
And then we got on. As I said, we got on a landline.
Yes.
We got the tactical phone. We called down to 3rd Air Force Headquarters at Ruislip. And then it was their job to disseminate it.
Okay.
You know, they collected all the information and then they disseminated it. So I never saw that part of it.
Right.
We just called it in. Or we would send a message. We also used Twixes back then.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd either called it. Usually what we did is we called it and then we sent a message as a confirmation.
Okay. So was that your backup communication?
Yeah.
Okay. There wasn't anything else besides those two?
None that I remember.
Okay.
There couldn't be anything else.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it.
Okay. Let's see. Well, how well did all of this prepare you for what you eventually did in Southeast Asia? That is, your initial training and then your experiences there in England.
For what I was doing, it prepared me. And if I had gone into photo interpretation, it would have prepared me. We were flying over North Vietnam. North Vietnam didn't have the jungle environment. I mean, it had the mountains and the trees and all that. But the enemy concentrations and the enemy factories and the what the North Vietnamese had was all in built-up areas. And the SAM sites were along the built-ups, you know, on the routes to the built-up areas. And the airfields were all in the built-up areas. So if I'd gone into photo interpretation, I would have been very well prepared. Going into air interpretation or air intelligence, it was the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the three threats were the MiG, the SAM, and the AAA. And so I think I was very well prepared for that.
Okay. Well, when
and I was especially well prepared, mm-hmm. because we were dealing with North Vietnam.
Okay. When you received your orders. You already said what your parents thought.
Yeah.
What went through your mind?
Well, I was a bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been there 2.5 years. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, at one point, I was even thinking of getting out of the Air Force there and going to school in Europe.
Mm.
And then word came down. All of a sudden, one day, rumors started to fly. I mean, they just flew, because what they did is they took 50 officers, and I don't remember any NCOs going on this deployment. They took 50 officers. Now, how many officers are there in a base where you have two tactical squadrons and support people? I mean, that's a big percent. And 45 of them were pilots. We didn't have navigators flying the RF-4C at that point. That's later on. So 45 were pilots and 5 were support people, a couple intel, a couple photo, a couple maintenance, you know, that type of thing. So the rumor started flying, and I started thinking about it, and you know, it didn't take long for us to figure out that it was for Udorn, Thailand. And a couple of things went through my mind. One is that there were 2 reconnaissance bases. And if I had stayed in the Air Force, I was probably going to stay in reconnaissance, and I had volunteered already to go to Mountain Home, Idaho. So there were 2 reconnaissance bases in Southeast Asia. One was Udorn, Thailand, and the other was Saigon. And this was for Udorn. So that's positive point number one. And number two was that I was single, and hey, this seemed exciting. So I remember calling the squadron commander. I was down in the squadron at this point, Colonel Sergeant. And I just said to him, if you're looking for volunteers, I volunteer. And he said, thank you. And the next day, my name was on the list.
Wow.
Now, the odds are I would have gone anyway, I think. I don't know, because I'd been there 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was single, although they didn't just send single people. The other intelligence officer was married.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't, or maybe all the rest were married. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
No? Well, whatever. So, you know, I don't know if I would have been picked, but I thought that would be exciting.
Yeah.
You know, go from one end of the world to the other.
Right. Well, of course, by the time you got there, the war had been going on for almost 2 years.
Yeah, October 66, I got there.
Yeah, so a little over 2 years. Of course, the Gulf of Tonkin incidents occurred in August 64, and then the resolutions were passed. What do you remember about that, if anything?
I don't. I mean, later on when I studied history, I studied the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure I read about it, and it was just a little blip in history. You know, just
mm-hmm.
it happened, and Congress had voted this. I didn't look at it. I didn't look at the political side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking at the military side.
Right. Well, as I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Okay. As you were preparing, in England during your first duty assignment there, what did you hear about the conventional military buildup in Vietnam and? Or did you have any thoughts about that?
Well, the main thought was that it was necessary. I mean, this is what I had said before, that I very vividly remember having a discussion with a friend and saying that, you know, I was a believer in the domino theory up until I got over there. But at that point, I believed in the domino theory. I believed that we had to do it. We had to draw the line, that we were in Europe because we were drawing the line, and we had to go to Asia and do the same thing, just as we had done in Korea. So I definitely remember thinking that way.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your trip over?
It was kind of exciting. Again, you know, going around the world is exciting. I took a 7 days leave back in New Jersey, flew to California, Hamilton Air Force Base. They gave us M-16 training for about 3 days. Then we went out to, I believe we took off from Travis. So we went out to, I'm assuming we left from Travis, because it was a military charter, a 707, which means slow by today's standards, although back then I guess it was fast. And we were on the plane forever. And a whole bunch of us from Alconbury were together in this one. So I remember playing cards the whole way over, because it was an all-military flight. And we were all together, and we knew the people, and that's what we did. I remember playing cards with the maintenance officer who went over, and that made the trip go quickly. And we flew into Saigon, Thon Son-nut, and we stayed at a place called Sam's. Remember, there was a recce unit in Saigon, you know, our sister unit.
Mm-hmm.
We were the 432nd up in Udorn, and I don't know what their number was. It might have been the 460th, I'm not sure. But anyway, there was a reconnaissance unit in Saigon, and we had contact with them, so they invited us. They knew about the chaos with housing in Saigon or Thon Son-nut, and so they invited us to stay at their hooch, which was guarded by Chinese nationalists. These were people left over from the war, the civil war in China. And when they came out, they didn't come out through Formosa, they came out through Southeast Asia. And so the U.S. government hired them to protect some of the facilities around Saigon, and I guess maybe even into South Vietnam itself. So the guards were Chinese nationalists. And we stayed there the one night, and then caught a, I think it was a 130 from Thonsonut to, what was it, Bangkok, Thon, was it Tom Wang? Pulling names out. I think that was the name of the air base at, in Thailand, Bangkok, Thailand. So we spent the night. I went into the town, went into Saigon, and bought myself a switchblade, my only protection for the whole year, switchblade knife. I carried around, and when I came back through Travis or San Francisco, when I came out, turned it into the customs people. So I was well protected for the year. I had a switchblade.
Yeah. Did you ever have to use it in anger?
No, never had any anger. Over there.
Okay.
Never. I only had one, well, I can tell you about that later, one incident.
Okay.
Yeah. So we spent, came in on one day and left the next day out of Saigon and saw the mist that was Thonsonut. Just pure, it just looked like chaos. I was so glad I wasn't there. Not just because it was Saigon, but just because Thonsonut was chaos.
How did it compare to Udorn?
Udorn was very civilized. It was a base in a small town. Of course, by Thailand standards, it was considered a city. It's one of the leading cities of Thailand. But it was almost like a big town rather than a city for us. The base was very well developed, and while I was there, it was even more developed. They put in, had a tennis court. They put in a handball court, a swimming pool, things like that. It wasn't as crowded as Thonsonut. It was more orderly. It just everything about it was better.
So you had no doubts in your mind that you made the right decision,
yeah.
Choice.
Yeah, and because the other thing about it that really stuck in my mind is that they knew we were coming. I mean, 50 of us. They knew we were coming, and they were prepared for us. They had a job. We knew exactly what to do. Whereas the impression I had about Saigon when we were wandering around Thonsonut before we left to go to Sam's, that's, again, I think what the hooch or the place was called, where the recce people stayed. And there was this tent with a lot of activity. So I walked into the tent, and there was a stage with an NCO with a list, the old clipboard. And, there had to be at least 100 people in the audience. And he was saying, okay, are there any A1E drivers here? And two or three guys would raise their hand. You're going to Pleiku, you're going to Thonsonut, you're going to Dum, whatever. Yeah. Are there any 702, that was the career field for personnel, which or administrative support, 702. Any 702 typists? So half a dozen people would raise their hand. You're going to Thonsonut, you're going to Pleiku, you're going to wherever, and you're going to wherever. I mean, that's what was going on. They just shipped a whole bunch of people there, and it was up to 7th Air Force to sort them out, whereas we were deployed, 50 of us,
mm-hmm.
and so it was very civilized in a lot of ways.
And when you arrived there at Udorn, they knew who you were and where you were going, by name.
Exactly. Okay. In other words, I had a job waiting for me.
Okay. And what exactly was that position?
That was the one, what I call air intelligence.
Yes.
The short version is briefing and debriefing the crews for the combat capabilities of the North Vietnamese.
Okay.
Air combat capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the big three.
Mm-hmm.
AAA SAMs and MiGs.
And this was with the 432nd Tactical Reconnaissance Wing.
Right.
Okay.
And it had two squadrons.
Okay.
I think one was the 20th, and the other, the RF-101s, I think, was the 20th.
Mm-hmm.
What was the RF-4C? I can't remember. I got my numbers, because I think the 1st and 30th were the two recce squadrons at Alconbury, and then so it was the 20th, and another one at Udorn. I can't remember, but I was stationed at the wing.
Okay. Well, what kind of briefings did you receive when you arrived there?
There was a guy, there was another lieutenant. I arrived as a first lieutenant, and there was a guy there, I say he was a lieutenant, he might have been a captain, and basically pulled us aside and No, I was the brand new one. Pulled me aside. The other went to photo interpreter, and just gave me the lowdown on everything. He spoke to me for hours on what was going on and the missions we were doing and the threat. And, I mean, it was an excellent briefing, but it was all his own. And then when he left, I ended up doing that with the new people who would come in. I followed his model. John Horde was his name. Yeah.
Okay.
It was around Fort Walden Beach, Florida.
Mm-hmm. What did he list or discuss concerning the threats?
Well, he talked about the whole mission approach, you know, what happened when they, how the frag sheet that came down, the TWIX, and how the missions were identified, BBB and nothing, double barrel, and you know, not quite a joyride, but you know, an easier mission. And then, the timing of the crews, when they would come in, what they would do, and then flying the mission, what the threat was, and he went into detail on the threat, and then coming back, and again, what our role would be as far as debriefing and reporting the information, which was all by TWIX. We would write it up, and then it would go to the comms center to be sent down to 7th Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. the whole procedure. The way that, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, the double B and the B.
No, I have not.
Well, you know, crews were, your first five missions and your last five or ten were supposed to be easy. And then, I guess if a crew had a particularly hard mission, they would want an easy one. Well, the way that Saigon told us is they would send the information the day before. They would tell the wing how many missions were going to be flown the next day. I mean, it wasn't that they came in the middle of the night, they said, oh, you're flying 20 missions today. I mean, that would be too late because you had to do maintenance and crew rest and stuff. Well, there was nothing. They didn't worry about crew rest. But anyway, you know, they would give advance warning the night before, and so it would come down, and I think they might have even called it in because they would say there would be, how many missions and about what time they'd be leaving, and then they'd put a BB, a B, and a plane. A BB was a double, you know, the barrel was Hanoi, Haiphong. Our responsibility, Air Force responsibility, was Hanoi. The Navy had Haiphong. So if there was a double B by this one mission, that meant you were going to the Hanoi area. If there was a B that was just stood for barrel, that meant you were going into Route Package 6, I believe, was the Hanoi. There was the outskirts of Hanoi further out. And if you had nothing, that meant you were going either over a safe area of North Vietnam or over Laos, which was considered safe. And then what the wing would do is they'd have these, let's say, 20 line numbers. Then they would assign airplanes and crews to those 20. And so if there's a double, if someone were on his 98th mission, well, they obviously are not going to give him a double B.
Okay.
Or even a B.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, early in the morning, after midnight, the TWIX would arrive with the actual mission. Mm-hmm. You know, fly from point A to point B or whatever you were doing.
Okay.
All part of Rolling Thunder.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah, this was, everything that you were involved with was part of Rolling Thunder.
Exactly. Yeah, because everything we were involved with was Laos and North Vietnam.
Okay. Now, how much, you were working a lot with the RF-4Cs, the RF-101s, but your briefings and your debriefings were with all pilots coming back, no?
Right.
Yeah.
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 And the enemy capability was the same. I mean, the tactics they flew were different.
Okay.
But as far as preparing them, you know, that was the same.
Okay.
Because they were flying the same routes.
Okay.
The only difference was that the RF-4C could go out at night.
Okay.
It had infrared, and it had, I don't know if the 101 had flares. The RF-4C had flares.
Okay.
But I don't know if they necessarily used them at night. They did use infrared, though.
Okay. How effective was that, to your understanding, the infrared that they used? Was it good?
It depended on the target. I remember one of the targets they ran against, they tried to destroy a power plant.
Okay.
And they bombed it during the day, and then I remember at night, I assume it was at night, because I saw the infrared photographs. I mean, why? Otherwise they would have used regular.
Right.
And, it was well lit up, which means that they were unsuccessful in that one.
Oh, okay.
But there weren't that many IR targets to fly against.
Yeah.
I mean, power plants, and that's about it. So,
right.
You know, most of it was regular old photography.
Yeah. Well, I guess in terms of your briefing and debriefing, would you do that with the, say, the bomber pilots or the fighter pilots, the escorts, or?
No, we never saw them. Our base only had recce.
Okay.
Well, I said it only had recce going over North Vietnam. Now, it had A1Es, and it had, I can't remember if they were deuces or mm-hmm. or sixes.
I see.
It had a flight of 104s, mm-hmm. but it had a lot of A1Es and, mm-hmm. and Jolly Greens, you know, the, for the search and rescue. Mm-hmm. But as far as North Vietnam capability, we only had those. Now, later mm-hmm. on, it changes at UDARN. Mm-hmm. But at this point, all we had were the two reconnaissance squadrons.
Okay.
The fighter bombers flew out of Yubon, Tak Li, Karat. And the NKP was more A1E type, support mm-hmm. of Laos.
Mm-hmm.
I'm missing a base. Tak Li, Karat, Yubon. Maybe that's it. Maybe the big three. Maybe that was it.
The reason I ask is one of the things that has come up with other pilots that I've talked to who say worked with, well, the best example, I guess, is Air America. Their flight information center.
But their big headquarters was at UDARN.
Right. They would debrief every pilot, no matter what they flew, and that afforded them a tremendous intelligence capability that would allow them to avoid dangerous areas, keep track of troop movements that might be a threat, and things of that nature. I didn't know if the other aircraft that might have been flying out of UDARN, if that was part of the...
No, it wouldn't have been, because the other aircraft flying out of UDARN
mm-hmm.
Were flying over Laos.
Yeah.
And Air America came over.
Yeah.
And there was a book out that was just, what a fascinating book, Barking at the Moon?
Oh, no, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
There was a guy there...
Mm-hmm.
CIA guy, Air America guy, by the name of Bill.
Bill
Lear? I remember Bill would come over, mm-hmm. and he would talk to the crews, and as a matter of fact, a little target of opportunity. Well, when you're coming back over Laos, could you tip down at Sam Nui, which was the communist capital,
mm-hmm.
and try and get a side view of this cave? And you know, he'd talk to the crews, and they would do it, and it was
cool.
All on the side, you know,
mm-hmm.
nothing official about it.
Yeah.
And Bill, you know, I met him over the Air America, had a very nice officers' club and a pool,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I met him there, and then when this book came out, I read it last year.
Yeah.
I said, I wonder just about Bill.
Yeah.
You know, how important was he?
Mm.
Well, guess what? He ran the whole war.
Yeah.
He was the main person in the book.
Right.
It was his war.
Right. You're talking about Roger Warner shooting at the moon.
Right.
And you're talking about Bill Lair.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's now a truck driver out of Texas.
Oh, he was. He's retired now.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that book, that was fascinating book to read,
mm-hmm.
especially since it, you know, so much of it was focused on UDARN.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. So as far as the cooperation between the Air Force and, say, the CIA, as far as Bill Lair was concerned, there was quite a bit of cooperation there.
For the year I was there, I mean, mm-hmm. I remember Bill talking to Cruz,
mm-hmm.
and no problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Was there a lot of sharing of intelligence?
Well, there was nothing to share, except if they flew a target of opportunity over Laos. Again,
mm-hmm.
we're going into North Vietnam.
Right.
I'd say that because they did fly Route 7 into the PDJ and,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, there were some, but the main emphasis was North Vietnam for our wing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally, you know, they would fly targets over Laos.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a lot of intelligence that we could have given them.
Well, what about trail work?
Well,
that is recce over the Ho Chi Minh Trail coming into Laos.
No, that wasn't our area.
Oh, it was not.
We were north. We went UDARN, again,
right.
I'm talking about the year I was at
right.
UDARN. We were north of UDARN. So when the only trail work we did was not a trail, it was a superhighway, it was a major road.
Of course, uh-huh.
you could argue the Ho Chi Minh Trail was a major road, but it was, I think it was Route 7 that came out of part of North Vietnam down to the PDJ, and then, of course, the roads coming from Sam Nui down to the PDJ.
Right.
So that was the big battleground, the PDJ.
Okay.
The Plains des Jars, I guess you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we didn't fly over what is classically known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Okay.
You know, Mugaya Pass, Nay
mm-hmm.
Pass, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was the responsibility. They divided it up. That was the responsibility of the, and I think it was the 460th, but I'm not sure, out of Saigon. They flew route packets 1 and 2, which is about up to Vinh. I only remember one or two missions around the Vinh area,
mm-hmm.
and nothing in the panhandle of the southern panhandle of Laos.
Okay.
That was all out of Saigon. That was their responsibility.
Okay. Do you recall any other specific special missions that Bill Lehrer made requests for? You mentioned the Sam Nui.
Well, we saw some of their classified Twixes.
And okay.
We knew that they were flying into Laos. We knew about the Lima sites. They had some of the most interesting airplanes you've ever seen, including this Swiss plane made for flying around the Alps, a turboporter. Can't remember, but it's one huge turboprop propeller, and I think it'd stop on a dime. I mean, literally. I remember there was a red light at the end of the runway, and whenever a plane would come in, you'd stop. And I had a motorcycle, and I remember one time I was stopped there, and here comes this turboporter. I think that's what it was called. And there was a little bit of a headwind, not much, and the pilot, it had full flaps, and it was just literally hanging in the air. and the split second before he touched down, he reversed pitch on the props, because you can just hear this, with the result that when he hit the ground, he rolled backwards.
Oh, my goodness.
And the reason he did that was because the Air America ramp was right on the end of the runway. By doing that, he wouldn't have to go down 500 or 1,000 feet and then come over to the taxiway.
Yeah.
He could just turn off right there. I mean, it was the most... And so these were the planes that were flying up on the Lima sites, all over Laos. They were supporting it. And so we'd get these messages. And I mean, there was a payroll plane that disappeared. And obviously someone had either, had taken the money. We knew what was going on. And they had all these, they had a C-130 that was painted pitch black.
Mm-hmm.
And we had heard that it was used for going up into North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all what we would hear.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a huge detachment. No, huge. It was a big detachment.
Okay.
We knew that they were running the war in Laos from there.
Yes, sir. Well, you mentioned just a moment ago that a payroll aircraft disappeared?
Yeah.
That was an Air America payroll aircraft?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, Air America.
Oh, goodness.
Now, when it says payroll, it doesn't mean pay to Air America.
No, payroll for, say, the Laotian forces that
exactly
we're working with.
And it was a twin. It was a German plane, Dorniers, again, twin turboprop.
Uh-huh.
And they had some of them, and that was, I think that was the one that disappeared. I remember one message, and this was in the book, and it was fascinating. One message talked about when some drug runners were coming across the border from Burma into Laos, and they were the Golden Triangle, and the Laotian Air Force attacked them, and this was described in the message. And when I read the book, it gave the gory details of that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Oh, that's exactly what happened."
Mm-hmm.
That is a fascinating book.
Yes, sir. Let's see. Was Bill Lehrer the only person on the agency side that you worked with, or do you recall others?
The only one I remember by name. I mean, there were other guys there.
Yeah.
But he was the one who mainly came over and talked to the air crews. He's the only one I remember specifically coming over.
Okay. And let's see.
Have you interviewed him?
Yeah, sure have.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Is it online?
We're transcribing it and editing the audio now. And it'll be online probably in the next week or so.
Oh, I definitely would read that one.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I think I'm making a note about it.
Okay. In terms of your support or your work with Air America, were there any joint missions that you guys did together?
Force? I mean, we wouldn't. Yeah. I mean, don't forget, we were recce. We were flying at medium to high altitude. We wouldn't have now. We also had A1Es there. The search and rescue A1Es, and they also were running bombing missions, and we had T-28s, the Royal Asian T-28s that American pilots were flying. And they would have, I mean, that's the group that would have worked directly with Air America, not us.
Okay. Good enough. Do you recall when your first briefing, debriefing occurred, and what the atmosphere was like?
I would have remembered it as October of 66. I mean, I wouldn't have remembered the detail. I'm sure they would have walked me through it the first time.
Yeah.
And then I felt very comfortable about it.
Okay.
I mean, as I say, it's not brain surgery.
No.
It wouldn't have taken long to understand what was going on.
Right. Now, what? Of course, SAMs and AAA were. Well, how would you rate the threats of the three that you've mentioned? SAM, AAA, and MIG.
The least threat for Recce was the MIG.
Okay.
The main threat, because they were, if they're flying at 20 to 25,000 feet, the main threat was the SA-2. And then the second threat would have been the AAA. Now, they had AAA that could get up to 20, 25,000, and some of our planes were hit by AAA. But the main threat definitely was the SAM. And they had 37 millimeter, which was more for low level, and I don't think that was a real threat. They had, 57 millimeter and 85. I guess the 57 and the 85 would have been able to operate at 20 to 30,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good enough. This will end the first interview with Mr. Alan Osher on the 18th of February. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Alan Osher on the 19th of February 2002 at approximately 2 o'clock Lubbock time, 1 o'clock Colorado time, and that's where Mr. Osher is. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with a discussion
okay.
of the missions that you remember, and in particular, if you would, go ahead and briefly describe the weather missions that you would fly, the weather
mm-hmm.
recce missions, and then also the battle damage assessment missions.
Yeah. The weather recce, they would go out. It was very early in the morning. I said, before the recording came on, I said 2, but it seemed to me it would have to be later than that. It would have to be at 4. When I worked the midnight shift, I went to breakfast around 2. And then I think when I came back, then a weather recce went out. So, I'm saying 3, 4 o'clock. So if it took an hour to get up there, they would have, they could give an early morning forecast. Now, in theory, that was a piece of cake. However, two buddies of mine went up on that mission and never came back. Now, there are two theories. One, they got low and they ran into a mountain going through the clouds, or the other is something happened, some kind of maintenance problem, and the plane crashed. I doubt, we would have picked up activity, or someone over the Gulf would have picked up activity if there had been a MIG jumping them, and I can't imagine a MIG coming out at night anyway, or early morning. So, we did lose a couple of crews that way, including, as I said, two buddies of mine who had come over from Alconbury.
Hmm.
So even though it was a piece-of-cake mission, I guess there was nothing really that was a piece-of-cake mission. I guess
yes,
that's a better way of putting it. But their job was just scouting. This was a force. We did have, I guess we had satellites, but I don't think they were good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I vaguely remember seeing some weather shots, but I think they just needed people to go out there and take a close look.
Mm-hmm.
And then the main mission was battle damage assessment, BDA.
Mm-hmm.
And if there were, a lot of it was just routine stuff, whether it be in Laos or North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have some missions were tied specifically to attacks by the fighters coming out of Yuban or wherever they were coming out of.
Mm-hmm.
The F-4Cs came out of Yuban, that wing, and then they had the Thuds came out of, I'm trying to think, Karat? I believe the Thuds came out of Karat.
Okay.
And then they had the EB-66s, I believe, came out of Tok Le, but I could be reversing them. That would be an easy thing for someone to check.
Mm-hmm.
So in those missions, they were sort of good and bad news. The bad news is that the enemy was wide awake, and the bombers, the fighter bombers had just come in, and then all of a sudden the recce's come over, so they could be a little bit upset. The good news is that the radar, they would run it up, they would use it, and they'd use their missiles, and then they'd turn the radar off, and they've shot their load of missiles. And so they didn't have, sometimes they didn't have more missiles to fire. Same thing with the MiGs. The MiGs
mm-hmm.
would try and stop the fighter bombers, and they'd be heading back to their base, so perhaps they weren't around the target. But the AAA was always there. And I think the AAA, I said before, yesterday, the SA-2s and the AAA, they were the main threats.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were the typical altitudes for the weather recce flights?
That I don't know at all.
Okay.
I mean, I really didn't pay too much attention to it, actually.
Okay.
They went out and came back.
Right.
And then I don't know how far they went or where they got to. And
mm-hmm.
you know, what they were looking at, other than clouds and no clouds.
Okay. And when the weather recommissions would go out, would you give them pre-flight briefings?
Everyone got the same. Yeah, definitely.
Known
the
locations.
The threat was always the same.
Okay.
And what we would do, we would report, when we debriefed the crews, we would report the information down to headquarters. Mm-hmm. We'd send a Twix down to 7th Air Force. They would consolidate it, and then they'd basically send it back to us.
Mm-hmm.
But we pretty much, you know, in a sense, we were on the front line, even though we were in Thailand, so we knew what the threat was. And there was one time when, you know, talking to crews, I thought that they were going to stick an SA-2 site way off into the western part, west of Hanoi, you know, way west. And so I warned the crews about that. And one day one of our pilots got shot down from that missile site. That was sort of my best guess,
mm-hmm.
that they're, you know, just suspicious activity. And mm-hmm. he was picked up. I think his name was Bob Patterson. I don't know if you want names, but
yeah, sure.
He was picked up, and I saw him, and he said, "Well, you warned us." you know, they were just coming back. They thought they were out of danger, and all of a sudden the Fansong radar came on, and bingo, a missile was sent up there. But they were picked up in Laos.
Do you know who picked them up?
Well, it would have to be the Jolly Greens.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the Jolly Greens would go out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, they were based at our base.
Right.
You know, you had the A1Es and you had the helicopters, but what they would do is they would deploy into Laos, mm-hmm. to get closer. And I'm assuming for especially big strikes, they would definitely be deployed in Laos.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're
that A1E is a, mm-hmm. was a fabulous plane.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable what it could carry. The armament and even they didn't. I guess they just had a crew of two, but it could have carried a lot more. But when we'd see it on the flight line, fully armed or with everything on it, it was just an amazing aircraft. I think I have a photograph of it someplace.
Do you recall if there were any? Well, we're on the subject of pickups, pilots that were shot down and picked up. Were there? Did you know firsthand of any Air Force pilots that were picked up by Air America?
No.
Okay.
When our pilots went down, they were not picked up, generally speaking. And I think the reason why Bob was picked up is because this was a surprise SAM site way out to the west. So, I'm guessing there was a route that came down, I think from DMVM Phu, came down the river, or came down the valley toward Hanoi, and it was way out there, and so it was north of Sam Nua in Laos. So we would be able to get people in there. That's the only one I can remember the whole year that who was picked up. I think both front and back seaters were picked up.
Okay. And let's see. The battle damage assessment recognitions.
Yeah.
Were these just for the A-1 Sky Raiders and the other
These were for the F-4s out of Ubon and the Thuds.
Okay.
No, these are for the major missions.
The major missions.
Yeah, the A-1Es had two roles. One was SAR, search and rescue, and the other was air operations in Laos.
Yes.
Those wouldn't have been, air operations in Laos wouldn't have been called a major mission. Later on, you know, that would be, but not in 66, 67. This is when they'd have many flights going after major targets,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd go in for the BDA.
Okay. Now, for these operations, did they not have a MIG cap running?
Yeah, they did, but not for the recce.
Hmm.
There's an interesting story. It's a long story, but it's one of these. It happened.
Okay.
There was a period of time, and I think it might have been the early 67, but I can't remember the exact timing, when all of a sudden MiGs started to come after the recce planes. And what it would do is it forced some to abort the mission, it forced some to, you know, jump around and maybe not get good BDA or whatever, but they started to come after the recces. But they never shot any down. But it caused a problem. So what 7th Air Force did is they assigned some fighters, MiG caps, for the recces. And what happened? I can laugh about it now, it wasn't a laughing matter then, is at least one of the MIGCAPs got shot down and at least a couple of them got battle damage. And none of the recces again were shot down, and someone put two and two together and said, just send the recce's out alone. We take fewer losses when they go out alone, even though they don't always get their target.
Right.
Because once they started putting the mid cap there, then they became targets. They would, then instead of two birds going out there, all of a sudden you had maybe six. And then it became a more attractive target, and they would try and jump them with MIGs. They would launch the SA-2s. So they, after a short time of the mid-cap getting battle damage, and I remember at least one was shot down, they decided to just kill that plan and let the recce's go out alone.
And to your knowledge, you never lost a recce aircraft to the MIGs?
Wow. That's a good question.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember ever. I mean, when we thought about who went down, it was always AAA and SA-2. I don't remember. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't happen during the course of that year, but I don't remember ever losing an RF-4C or an RF-101, because we had the 101s there. Soon after I left, then the 101s were replaced by the RF-4Cs.
Mm-hmm.
So there were two RF-4C squadrons instead of one of each, but I don't remember any of them being shot down by MIGs.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting dilemma, but also an interesting tactical situation, because, of course, the RF-4C, this was, how different was this from, say, one of the, perhaps the F-4s that were flying the MIGCAP or the other aircraft?
Yeah, they were identical planes.
Right.
Except, obviously, the radar was different.
Right.
The RF-4C had ground mapping, whereas the MIGCAP had the airborne and the armaments and all that, but it was basically the same airplane.
Could the RF-4C, the recon bird, the recce bird, fly faster than the air-to-air?
No, I think it was, I don't think that's what the issue was, because they couldn't fly faster.
Right.
Because they all had dropped their tip tanks by then.
Uh-huh.
No, the issue was that instead of two planes, now you had six planes. And I think, this is my own guess, that the issue was that now you had a bigger target.
Hmm.
I really think that's what the issue was.
Interesting.
Wasn't that the, and so then they put more emphasis on it.
Okay.
Boy, we have six planes coming in. Okay, let's try and shoot them down. Well, there's just two, and, we got to get the fansong going, and we've already used a lot of our allotment of SA-2s for today, maybe leave them alone.
Right.
I mean, they knew which were the recces and which were the fighter bombers.
Right. But from the standpoint of the MIGs that were sent up, when you mentioned earlier that some of the guys that were flying MIG-CAP were shot down by MIGs.
Right. Or I say by MIGs, they were shot down on that mission.
Okay.
Now, they might have been shot down.
Not necessarily because of air-to-air combat.
Right. Okay. And I can't remember exactly how they were, but they were shot down, and it could have been, again, just the SA-2s, the AAA, or the MIGs. I don't know which it was. It may not have been from the MIGs at all, but all of a sudden they presented a better target.
Yeah. Where would those types of missions typically occur? Were these over Laos, North Vietnam, or both?
No, Laos, you keep coming, in a sense, coming back to Laos when you mention like the A1Es. Laos was, unless someone did something stupid, I don't think anyone was even came close to being shot down over our area of Laos.
Okay.
Remember, we're up north. We're not in the panhandle.
Right.
I think the biggest they had was 37 millimeter, and if our planes are flying at 20,000 feet to take pictures over Laos, that's not going to be a concern. I mean, if they're just sweeping down a road, they can be at 20,000 feet, and they can get good intelligence from 20,000 feet.
Okay.
And if they have the ZPU 23s and the 37 millimeter along the road, they're not going to hit anyone at 30,000 feet, or 20,000, excuse me.
Yeah.
So the missions were always up north. In the Hanoi area. Remember, the Navy had Haiphong.
Mm-hmm.
Saigon, if it is the 460th, had route packet 1 and 2 up to Vinh, well beyond Vinh. There was nothing between there and way up north, so our tough missions were the Hanoi area and the whole Red River Valley and all around there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the major targets were that we would go after.
Okay.
We being the Air Force.
Okay. I didn't know if as you said, you were flying BDA recce missions for some of the other units that weren't stationed there at Udorn with you, but I thought maybe perhaps they were flying missions maybe over the trail in Laos, the truck parks and things like that that eventually became exposed.
Yeah, that would have been the other units.
They would have flown their own BDA then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I I mean, you know, I can't say it categorically, but I don't remember any missions down into the Panhandle.
Okay.
Now, it was interesting about the jamming that the RF-101s had and the RF-4Cs had. The 101, in a sense, didn't have a jammer. It had a deflector.
Okay.
And what would happen, they went up in groups of two also, generally speaking, you know, flight of two. What would happen is with the 101s is the radar, the Fansong signal would come up, and instead of jamming it, their system, which I'm assuming was an older one, would deflect it. So someone looking at their scope down in the Hanoi area will see a great big return, and then, you know, sort of like, wow, you know, this is great. And they, and the 101s, I mean, their nickname were the magnet asses, because they used to get everything thrown at them with the SA-2, because they presented these big targets. Now, you know, it deflected it, but you get enough missiles thrown at two planes, and with proximity fuse and everything, I mean, they're going to take some losses that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember debriefing the crews that would come back, and they would be all shook up because they'd have 10, 20 missiles thrown at them. And it just, even though in theory they were off to the side, it just scared the hell out of them.
Yeah.
All, you know, there were enough missiles coming up to really scare them.
When
so that's, that's what they had.
Yeah. When you say off to the side, what range would those
I don't know. I don't know the technical side. I just know that, you know, talking to them about their deflector, I call it deflector, I don't know what they called it, but talking to them about it and the number of missiles and just, you know, it presented a gorgeous target, slightly off center, but that meant that the North Vietnamese threw more missiles at them because it was a better target.
Right.
Now, the RF-4C had a jammer, but there was a, maybe this wasn't a problem, they had to fly close to straight and level for it to work. And so they would. They would fly in formation. And what happened is they were augmenting or they were supplementing each other. Sort of, you know what I mean? I'm using the wrong words, but you know what I mean? Complementing. That's the word. They were complementing each other. And that was good. As long as they came close, you know, they could do go up and down and do gradual turns, you know. And they would do that over the target area, because when they were ever in SA-2 territory, that's what they would do. The bad news is if they got separated too far, what would happen is it would isolate them. In other words, it would presented a better target to the Fansong operator on the ground, but in this case, it was a realistic target. And I have a couple of photographs of an SA-2 hitting one of our RF-4Cs, and what had happened is they had become separated, and then they launched missiles at it, and one of the missiles, the, you could just see the proximity fuse just exploded, and it just you know, knocked the plane out of the sky. The plane went in for a, I don't know what the term is, not a loop, but its nose went down and it flipped over.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were positive that both pilots were killed, and found out later that both pilots had gotten out. Of course, they were POWs, but they had gotten out of that plane.
Wow.
And that was amazing. But that's because they isolated themselves. They got too far apart, then they became good targets. And then one of them actually did get shot down. And the other one came back. He had his cameras on, and there were the photos. Just an amazing photo.
Wow.
I have another photo of two, well, RF-101 taking a photo of his buddy, and you can see the AAA going off around them. So that had to be the 57 or the, I think it was 85, that's the big stuff.
What camera was used to take these photographs? Was it the onboard camera? Or
yeah, the onboard camera.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, these were the onboard. In the case of the RF-4C, they had this camera that would swing from horizon to horizon. So the other plane that got shot down was alongside of it, so it was actually caught in the frame.
Okay. That's remarkable.
Yeah. I'll have to send you all these.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, I have this collection. I have 35 millimeter slides from UDorn and stuff like that. And I guess it'd be better for you to have it than for me. I mean, we're not talking about anything that's very valuable. The valuable stuff, I unfortunately had to throw away. I brought back, this is in '67. I brought back a great, or I sent back classified, a great package of photography targets. And because it was either infrared, and infrared was automatically classified, or it had the JCS target number on it, that made it classified. So they kept it at storage at the academy for a while, and then they called me one day, because I taught at the academy for 9 years. They called me one day and said, what do we do with this stuff? And I couldn't find anyone to take it, so they had to destroy it.
Oh.
Yeah, this is, you know, so that would have been around 68. And it was just great stuff that I had accumulated, illegally, of course, but I had accumulated over there.
No, but 68, had the classifications run out on that stuff?
Or? No, because it was still, you know, the JCS numbers were still classified, and the, I don't know at what point the infrared photography was no longer classified, but that was automatically, because I guess if you looked at the frame, you could determine our infrared capability.
Yeah.
I'll look through what I did on a couple of photos, not many, as I cut out the JCS number.
Okay.
But one of them was infrared of a power plant that supposedly was knocked out, but you could see the emission. You could see that it was still working.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I remember that was one of them, but that's, you know, unfortunately it's gone.
Yeah.
But I'll, you know, over the course of time, I'll look through my 35 millimeter slides and send you whatever.
Okay. Well, the when you were debriefing the pilots, especially the pilots that you described as coming back a little bit shook up because so much was thrown up at them. You know, what was their frame of mind? And how well, I mean, did you, how would you tailor your debriefing depending upon the mental state of the pilots?
Well, number one, we'd offer them some mission whiskey.
Okay.
number one, first thing, came into the room, what would you like to drink?
Yeah.
Right there. You know, wide open. There was two types of mission whiskey. The Air Force actually provided the cheapest rock gut brandy and whiskey you'd ever, I don't know where they got this stuff from. And so the Air Force provided it. But I sort of had a, you know, maybe it was a guilt feeling, because remember I was supposed to go to pilot training and didn't, and here I was a ground pounder and they're going off. I ended up buying my own. And I had a good collection of mission whiskey, you know, good scotch and good bourbon and good Canadian and all that. And so when I debriefed them, they got the good stuff.
Okay.
So, number one, relaxation. That's certainly the best way I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it just flowed from there. I mean, they were anxious to talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was important for them to talk about. I mean, this is the 60s. You know, booze was the number one drug in the Air Force, in the military. There's a story I put down in my written interview.
Yes.
Kind of fits here. For about 3 months, and then after that, shift work, I worked the midnight shift. We went from about 11 to 7 in the morning, something like that. And I did it for three solid months. And every morning, you know, things got really quiet at about 2, so I'd go over and get breakfast at the officers' club. And I remember one time I was over there, and they were just partying. And couldn't this friend of mine, Bob, who flew 101s, and they were drinking and partying, just having a blast. And that was at like 2 in the morning. Well, 5 o'clock in the morning, who comes in for a morning briefing is Bob. And I knew him well enough to ask the question. I said, I saw you really drunk a few hours ago, and here you are ready to fly your mission. And he said, well, remember I mentioned yesterday, he said, I saw that I had a double B by my name, and that was the only way I could get through the night. Because he knew where he was going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was he really sober enough to fly, do you think?
Oh, I wouldn't want to speculate.
Okay.
I mean, you know, when I had the discussion with him, he seemed to be sober.
Yeah.
But he certainly was drinking and partying. Now, maybe he wasn't really greatly drunk, but he certainly, a few hours before, was definitely partying and drinking. I did see that. But then we could have that intellectual discussion when he came in.
Okay. So he seemed clear-headed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was very honest. He said, you know, this is the only way I could get through the night.
Wow. Did you witness much of that amongst other pilots as well? The need, perhaps, to imbibe a little bit?
Oh, the drinking, yeah. I mean, the booze, of course, salaries were a lot lower then, but you know, the booze you could buy, I think the class six was at the club. Mm-hmm. The booze you could buy and for a few bucks and get a bottle. And yeah, mm-hmm. The club was a great social life, mm-hmm. definitely.
Okay. And you mentioned in the questionnaire, the written interview, that about the MiGs again, that they weren't necessarily a serious danger.
The what?
That you mentioned that the MiG-21.
Yeah, the MiG-21, right.
It was not necessarily a
significant
danger.
For the recce.
Yeah, but it did, as you put it, soil the underpants of a number of crews.
Right.
Do you mean that literally or figuratively?
figuratively.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite expressions. Uh-huh. But, you know, what would happen? That was a reason to abort the mission, uh-huh. because if the MiG came up at you, you know, the only thing you could do is run. The MiG could outturn you, mm-hmm. but you know, once you could get going, you had the speed, mm-hmm. and so you could outrun it. Mm-hmm. If you were, you know, speculating, you know, mm-hmm. let's say 30 miles from your target, and the MiG came on you, I mean, if the MiG could corner you over North Vietnam, you know. I mean, over the Hanoi area, well, you know, that would be terrible. I mean, mm-hmm. you'd be a sucker. So, you know, they would turn and run. Mm-hmm. But having said that, it didn't happen that often because, you know, the MiGs were used against the fighter bombers generally when there was a lot of traffic and activity and they would come in. The recce birds were flying high. Don't forget, over the Gulf of Tonkin, you had, what was that called, Looking Glass? No, that's not Looking Glass. That's SAC. You had the EC-121s mm-hmm. flying over the Gulf, and they could, as soon as a MiG took off, they could call out a MiG alert, mm-hmm. and they had that was one of the things we had in our briefing before they went out, was the MiG alert mm-hmm. Call. Mm-hmm. So if they were flying, and let's say it's Goose or something like that, and so if they call out, you know, this is call sign such and such Goose, or just start yelling Goose, Goose, or something like that, then they knew there were MiGs in their area. They better get out of there. Mm-hmm. But again, for recce, it didn't happen that often.
When the MiGs did show up, what was there a typical number, or did it vary, of MiGs that would show up?
I think, I'm digging deep into memory.
Yeah.
I think it was, for the recce, it was more single.
Okay.
And actually, I think it might have even been that way for the fighter bombers.
Hmm.
I think you'd have to talk to someone else who looked at those tactics.
Uh-huh.
But I think the recce, they did come in single.
Did the recce aircraft have any kind of weapons on them at all?
No, absolutely none.
Okay.
Alone, unarmed, unafraid. That was the, you know, what they went by.
Mm-hmm.
Alone,
the motto.
Alone, unarmed, and scared. But they, and, you know, they made, the Air Force made it, that.
Pardon?
The Air Force made a decision. They said that if we arm the recces, mm-hmm. then they're not going to stay with their primary mission.
Oh, good point.
Yeah, I mean, that was the reason why. It was pure and simple that you arm recces and you have a MiG coming in, they're going to go after the MiG. Or,
yes.
They're going to play around. They see a target of opportunity, they're going to go after that target.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was pretty well proven to be true for the Vietnam War, at least from what I saw.
Are you speaking from the standpoint of facts?
Well, yeah, I think they did a good job of performing their mission because they weren't running around looking for other targets.
Mm-hmm.
I think from that point of view, it was true. And considering that the main threat were the AAA and SA-2s, mm-hmm. which they couldn't do anything about anyway,
mm-hmm.
I think that also proves the point.
Okay.
I mean, if the main threat had been MiGs and they weren't armed, then you could argue that they should have been armed, but the main threat for them wasn't the MiG.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the pilots, you know, I think there's a different type of pilot training, being a recce pilot than a fighter bomber and a MiG cap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are different levels of flying.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of that, one of the things the Air Force did about halfway through the tour, so that might have been early 67, they made a really good decision. When we first got the R-4Cs at Alconbury, we got them in, you know, about 65, they had two pilots, the front seater and the back seater. And the one in the back was called the Gib, the guy in back.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had two pilots in this plane, and then what they decided to do, I'm guessing early 67, is put a navigator in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
And then so you had a pilot and a navigator. And the first crew, they did that at UDORN, pilot's name was Bob, and I can't remember, it might have been Holloway, I can't remember the backseaters. That, I mean, just from table talk, that seemed to be the most proficient crew, mainly because the navigator was in the back seat, and the navigator knew how to navigate.
Okay.
Whereas the pilot, that was a secondary role for the pilot, navigation. For the navigator, it was the primary role. And they were doing a lot of navigating because when they, a lot of, you know, sometimes they went high into the targets, other times they went low into the targets through the mountains and through the inevitable cloud cover. And so the navigator then was the one who kept an eye on things.
Okay.
And got them through there.
Now, how would they deal with cloud cover? Would they, I mean, if the cloud cover were below, or were, if the ceiling were too low at a
they'd abort the mission.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they had to take photos. They didn't have anything that could really shoot through the cloud cover. You know, maybe you could argue that IR could, but they wouldn't be able to see the target.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about big radar returns, which is, again, why you needed a navigator back there to take advantage of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So cloud cover, they just turn around and come home.
Okay. And that's what those weather recce missions were supposed to help isolate before they even got in the air?
Well, the radar, I think the weather recce was more for the fighter bombers.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it was more for that.
Okay.
Than for the recce. Because you know, if the fighter bombers were going out early in the morning, we were the closest base to North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was a good place to, you know, we were the logical ones to send those birds out.
Right. Okay. This will end interview number two with Mr. Alan Osher. This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Alan Osher on the 20th of February 2002 at approximately 10:30 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Alan Osher is in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Sir, why don't we go ahead and start with a continued discussion of your experiences in debriefing. And in particular, I was wondering if you know, what other techniques. You mentioned, the use of alcohol to help help the people you debrief relax. Were there any other techniques that you developed over time and trying to, you know, to cull information from pilots that you debriefed after missions?
See, that wasn't a, you're almost asking the question as if it would be a problem. And it wasn't a problem because when they came back, the worse the mission, the more they wanted to talk about it.
Okay.
I mean, again, you're implying that we had to drag the information out of them, and that wasn't so.
Okay.
I mean, they were perfectly willing and happy and to talk about it. And, you know, that you have to understand that they, you know, this is my impression, they survived a difficult mission. And the worse the defenses were, the better they felt about surviving it, and they were very happy to talk about it and even brag about it. I remember, you know, they said the RF-101, they were called the magnet asses. And when they survived one of those 10, 15, 20 SAMs being launched at them and they came back, I mean, they would, it was almost to the point of bragging. You know, look what I survived. This is where it happened. This is what happened, and so on. So it was not difficult at all. I mean, the mission whiskey was almost like a reward for them, or at least from my point of view, when I bought the better stuff, a reward for them. And it helped, maybe helped relax them a little bit, but but talking was not an issue.
Well, I guess maybe I didn't mean to make that impression, but perhaps the missions that were less eventful, where guys weren't shot at, was there a difference in your approach to them? Since, as you just pointed out, the guys that survived the more horrendous missions were very eager to talk. Was there any difference in the guys that didn't get?
No, not really. I mean, you know, it didn't take long for us to get experienced. I mean, we knew what they were going through. Matter of fact, they would have a call sign. They would have something. If they encountered MiGs, for instance, when they called in and they were coming back home, they would use that, whatever the reserve word was for MiGs. And that was a warning. And so we knew what they had experienced. I mean, it was, you know, very quickly. And and so, you know, it's just like talking to anyone, you know your job. In other words, I knew I had studied the North Vietnamese defensive capabilities. I knew what they had. I knew what the pilots went through. So it was just a question of putting two and two together.
Okay.
Getting to relax, sit there, and talk about their experiences. I mean, really nothing special except as a professional, you learn everything you can about the job. And you know, I felt that all of us were, all the intelligence officers there were half a dozen of us or so, you know, we're all professionals. You know, we all went through the same learning curve, and the first few times it'd be someone, an experienced person with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be watching them, and then we would take over, and they would be watching us, and then we were on our own.
Okay. Now, did you ever debrief anyone else besides U.S. Air Force personnel?
No.
Okay.
We never had any Vietnamese personnel on our base.
Okay.
We had Royal Laotian airplanes at our base, or let's put it this way, we had T-28s with the markings of the Royal Laotian Air Force,
mm-hmm.
but I never saw any of those pilots. Now, they could have existed. If they did exist, they probably were in the Air America environment,
mm-hmm.
And I, you know, we didn't have any, like, Australians or anything else. You know, we didn't have anyone else at our base,
mm-hmm.
And I don't remember ever, I mean, occasionally with battle damage that we'd have an F-4 would land, or maybe even a Thud. And I don't remember them coming into the intelligence unit or the operations area to be debriefed by us.
Okay.
We wouldn't have known what to do anyway.
Okay.
You know, their mission was entirely different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In those Royal Laotian aircraft that were there on your base, were those? Do you know if those were part of Project 404?
I never heard of Project 404.
Okay. But
they were. Was it General Ma was the head of the Air Force? It's mentioned in the book, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Barking at the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how they got to U-Dorn,
mm-hmm.
and they really, they had insignias that changed. Because I think they also flew under the Royal Thai Air Force. So whenever they, depending on the mission, I guess, they could change it and slide in the Royal Laotian Air Force or Royal Thai Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And that book actually was a better authority on, mm-hmm. on those planes.
Okay.
I took American pilots flew them also, or mm-hmm. primarily, I'm guessing, maybe
mm-hmm.
entirely. Because, no, I can't say entirely, because I remember talking to people and they said there were some Laotian pilots flying them too.
Okay.
Now, that might have been a stereotype of Asians, because when I read in the book, they actually had Thai pilots flying them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, very, you know, that might have been our stereotype. Okay, they were Asians and they originally came from Laos, therefore they were Laotians flying them, and they actually could have been Thais flying them.
Right.
But I do know Americans flew them. They had a unit there, because I took a couple of flights in the T-28. They went out. There was a range outside of U-Dorn, and they took off and flew down to the range, did their strafing and bombing practice there, and then came back. So I went up twice with them, and these were American pilots.
And how did, when you left that experience, what was your opinion of the T-28?
I upchucked on both flights.
Okay.
I was holding on for dear life.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, you know, going down, it was nothing. It was the leveling out on the bottom and coming up was... So I really didn't have... was not in a good position to comment about the capabilities of the T-28.
Okay.
That's why I gave up on that one.
Uh-huh.
I also had a flight on an RF-4C right before I left, as sort of a reward. One of the pilots took me up on a test hop,
mm-hmm.
and he went up over North Vietnam and Laos, and I remember it was a full test hop, so he had to go to Mach 2, and then they had to hit the deck, and they were doing a 500 knots on the deck. And it was obviously, there were very, very safe places in North Vietnam where you could go, and very safe places in Laos. And I think I took my camera along, and I probably have 35mm slides of that one.
Mm-hmm. How did you fare on that flight?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Okay.
But I remember specifically telling the pilot, tell me when you're going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the T-28 went out there, and all of a sudden we're heading straight to the ground, and all of a sudden we're heading back up in the air. And,
mm-hmm.
It was a surprise.
What did you think about the Mach 2 in that?
I didn't really have a sensation.
Huh.
Yeah, when I think back of it, uh-huh. it was more... Going along the ground at ground level at 500 knots was much more of a sensation. When you're at high level, I didn't, you know, okay, we're at Mach 2. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I didn't think anything special of it.
But when you're at the ground,
you have more of a sensation because the ground's flying back, flying by you at very rapid speed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see.
The things you can get away with over there, such as taking a non-rated person up on a test hop over North Vietnam and Laos.
Yeah, you can't get away with that kind of stuff stateside.
Today, no.
Let's see. Well, are there any other missions? Oh, well, I'm sorry, about the F-4 flight that you took. Mm-hmm. Did you guys get shot at?
No, as I said, there's very, I mean, they wouldn't have.
Yeah, there were safe areas, but.
He would, no. I mean, you know, you just, you know, shooting at airplanes in North Vietnam was a major effort.
Mm-hmm.
You just didn't do it. I'm talking from the North Vietnamese point of view. You know, the MiGs, every time the MiGs took to the air, it was a major threat. I mean, it was a major threat to the MiG because we had those EC-121s off the coast, and as soon as they got up out of the ground shadow, the ground clutter, you know, they were picked up. The SA-2, you had to the Fansong radar, and you had to get that up. And if there were any wild weasels in the area, you know, you could be a target. AAA was only, unless you're right on the deck, was only really effective in barrage. So, you know, if you're coming in the Thai Nguyen Iron and Steel, and you have 37 and 57 and 85s all around there, well, one 57 millimeter gun is not going to hit an airplane, unless you know, just talking damn luck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one gun is not going to hit, but 10 guns of 57s and 10 guns of 85s setting up, it's just like World War II.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they got over the target, the bombers, you know, they hit the flak.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was barrage. You know, one shot was not going to get them unless it was a very lucky shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the odds are, you know, you go over safe area of North Vietnam and Laos, I mean, they're not going to start firing at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first of all, when you're at altitude, you know, again, you have that situation I just described.
Mm-hmm.
There were no MiGs there, there were no SAMs, and there wasn't enough AAA to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're at ground level doing 500 knots, you know, they're not going to have time to react. They didn't have radar picking you up.
Okay.
In those areas, the radar was up by Hanoi Haiphong,
mm-hmm.
and maybe in Vinh. I'm not sure. They might have been in Vinh. But, again, that was the unit down in Saigon that covered Vinh.
Mm-hmm. Now, how consistent were the recognitions over specific targets? Like you just mentioned that run, the Iron and Steel run.
Yeah.
I mean, were the BDAs and the other recognitions, did they cover the same targeting areas a lot?
Yeah. I mean, that one, once it was destroyed, then it was destroyed, and then it was just routine. But I remember the way they destroyed it is they came in on the deck, and they
mm-hmm.
surprised the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
In a flight. Matter of fact, General Olds, I believe, led that flight, and he's still alive in Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Hmm.
He's got to be in his 80s and just a dynamic person. He
mm-hmm.
was the commander at Yukon.
Okay.
It'd be a very interesting guy that no one's conducted an oral history of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read something recently that says that he's alive in Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Okay.
Might be someone you'd want to contact.
Absolutely.
But then he was Colonel Olds, and then he became general when he took over as Commandant of Cadets at the Air Force Academy in 67, and then he went on to Director of Safeties.
Mm-hmm.
I think he retired out of that as a one-star, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
And
that's OLDS?
Yeah.
Okay.
Robin's first name, Robin Olds.
Okay.
I'm sorry, what was your question? I got sidetracked.
Oh, just the consistency of recce missions over specific targets.
Yeah, so on that mission,
mm-hmm.
you know, he took in a flight, and I don't know, it might have been more than a flight. I think of a flight as four, but there might have been more. And they came in low level and surprised the North Vietnamese and
mm-hmm.
caused damage.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went in, and if I remember right, we went in a couple of times, and there was because of cloud cover, we could not determine what the BDA was. And then what happened is one of our crews, the one with the navigator, so it was considered like our best crew,
mm-hmm.
just the navigator in the back seat, they came in low level.
Mm-hmm.
And the photography, and I still have one or two photos from that run,
mm-hmm.
and they came in low level and were able to you know, take good below the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that because the bombers had come in, fighter bombers had come in low level, they were expecting recce to come in low level. And so when they picked up a blip, they just shot away at the plane. And I remember talking to the crews when they came back.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if I debriefed them or I just was talking to them because I knew them. and they were just all shook up.
Yeah.
They got, I mean, everything thrown at them.
Mm-hmm.
Everything being AAA, because they were low level.
Yeah.
You know, the SA-2 wouldn't have done any damage to them. And they came in low level, and then everything was waiting for them. But they got through and got good photography and confirmed the damage. So after that, it just would be a routine thing, you know, nothing special.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So a lot of the BDA was in conjunction with the strike, and then a lot of it was just routine. You know, I wonder what's going on in this facility or that facility.
Mm-hmm. Now, were some of these flights follow-up flights, recce flights, to make sure that a specific facility or factory,
yeah,
or something was not back up and running?
Yeah, that's what I meant by routine.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Routine BDA after that, or routine mission, just to double check it,
uh-huh,
to see what was going on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we had a combination of the two.
Okay. Well, do you know of if it was possible for them to trick the recce missions?
Yeah, there were very few strategic, you know, this is a guess.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't have empirical evidence on this.
Yeah.
There were very few strategic targets. You know, mm-hmm, we're talking about strategic targeting.
Yeah.
And there were very few strategic targets, and I think it would have been difficult. I mean, because of the type of camera work we had. You know, let's say you had a power plant. You know, I mentioned the one where we thought we had destroyed a power plant, and then one of our planes went over it and could see, you know, with IR photography, got a great return. Well, that meant the power plant was still running. You know, it would be hard to set up a factory, and I guess you could burn coal or wood in there to pretend that's the power plant. I mean, I don't remember any of that. The tricking mainly was moving the SA-2s and the AAA around. But that, you know, so they probably had dummy guns. Mm-hmm. Sit around. When you think about World War II, and maybe even Korea, but I don't know, but World War II with tricking, and these were with tanks and trucks and stuff like that. Well, we weren't going against tanks and trucks.
Right.
You know, that would be, you know, that trickery, I'm guessing, would be down in the Ho Chi Minh Trail,
mm-hmm,
you know, where, you know, you could do something like that. We, mm-hmm, were going against strategic targets,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, we're trying to knock out bridges. We also called trying to knock out swinging bamboo bridges at times.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was harder. I mean, they'd be destroyed and they'd rebuild them.
Yeah.
So the North Vietnamese seemed to put all their effort into just rebuilding,
mm-hmm,
what was destroyed.
Because,
mm-hmm, I think it would have been just too difficult. Now, at the different airfields, I'm sure they could have had dummy airplanes, but we weren't allowed to go after the airfields,
right,
because they were within a radius of Hanoi, whatever,
mm-hmm,
the radius was,
yeah,
that we weren't allowed to go. We weren't allowed to go near the Chinese borders. It was like a buffer zone of 25-30 miles, and,
mm-hmm,
and then there was a buffer zone around Hanoi, Haiphong. At that point in the war, we weren't allowed to go into.
Mm-hmm. But did that zone of exclusion include recce missions?
Yeah.
You couldn't even fly a recce mission over those things?
Well,
couldn't bomb them, but...
I know the Chinese border, that was definite. All aircraft couldn't. I don't remember us flying missions you know, where the bombers wouldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, over the airfields, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we had to, because what was it called? Fujian was the Hanoi International.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm assuming we had intelligence on the ground that told us that where there were X number of MiG-21s and X number of MiG, whatever they had, 17s.
Mm-hmm.
MiG-21 was the main threat.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of that, there was something that happened that was interesting, and I put this in the written report.
Mm-hmm.
The Arab-Israeli War, called the June War,
mm-hmm,
of June 1967,
mm-hmm,
Israel went across the Sinai and captured SAM sites and MiG-21s. And it's obvious that they also flew the MiG-21s,
mm-hmm,
because they also tested the SAM sites. Because right after the war, like within a month after the war, now I left in October of 67, and the war was in June, so I remember seeing the classified top secret Twixes that came in between June and October,
mm-hmm,
and it talked about the capabilities of the MiG-21 and the capability of the SA-2,
mm-hmm,
that this, I think, was the first time we had captured a MiG-21. And I don't know if the Israelis flew it, because that was their main threat, too. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing it was a combination that the Israelis flew it and also the American pilots flew it. And then they did whatever analysis they had to do on the SA-2, because they captured airfields intact and in the Sinai, and also SA-2s intact.
Okay.
And then, again, the main concern with the 21 was the turning, and our pilots talked about that when they came in, and if they encountered it, they said, well, we saw the MiG, and then all of a sudden it turned inside of us. Knew exactly what that meant. Turning radius was very good, but okay. Then they were able to accelerate and get out of there.
Okay. And how about do you remember anything about the SAM?
I don't know. I just remember they talked about it, but I don't remember. You know, for our planes, for the RF-4Cs, they had that jammer. As long as they flew, you know, relatively straight and level, and of course that made them more vulnerable to AAA.
Right.
As long as they did that, they were a little bit safer. And I don't remember what it said about that, but I do remember that it was obvious that American pilots were. That the report had been written by a pilot flying that plane, either American or Israeli.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because the message came in right after the war. I may say right after, sometime between June 6th and when I left in October, and it said something like, an unidentified source has passed along the following information about the capability of the MiG-21. You know, unidentified source.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was obvious where. What the source was, because all you had to do was read Time and Newsweek, and you knew that they had captured MiG-21s and SA-2s.
Mm-hmm. How much do you think that affected the U.S. policies, just as a sideline here, since obviously the capabilities were important, or the information about the capabilities were important for us to have, if we could get them. Do you think that need for that kind of intelligence affected U.S. policies in the Middle East at the time?
Yeah, very definitely, because this is the transition period when France had been the main provider of particularly aircraft, but armaments for the Israelis. And then this is the transition period when France, under de Gaulle, is pulling away from that, and the U.S. has taken up the slack.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a sort of a goodwill gesture. But this is also the war of when they had the USS Liberty attacked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible Israel was making up for that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I think it would have.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Any other?
Yeah, there's one other story. Again, I put it on the on the written report, but it's worth repeating. Yeah, at our base, we had every possible type of airplane, and Air America had every aircraft you could think of, all specialized stuff. Including, as I mentioned, the turboporter and then the two-engine Dernier, and they had I remember seeing a C-130 that was completely painted black, and we had the A-1Es and the Jolly Greens and the RF-101s, and then we had either deuces or sixes for air defense. They would just fly around. No real role for them, and I can't remember if it was a 102 or a 106, but we had a flight of them. But we also had a flight of 104s. And I don't know if the 104 was used in any other base in the Vietnam War. Now, the historical context is that the 104, a man on an engine, as someone called it, was sold to all of our allies in Europe, to all of our NATO allies, was the main air defense weapon, I guess, in Europe. And what I'm guessing, I never saw anything in print, but all of a sudden you have this flight of 104s over there. What I'm guessing is that we had sold so many to the Allies, to NATO forces, that they figure they better do something with it in the Vietnam War because we weren't using it in Vietnam. Well, the reason we weren't using it in Vietnam is because it had no role in Vietnam. I mean, it's air defense, plane or bomber coming in. I mean, there was nothing like that in Vietnam. So what they did is they sent them to Udorn and they put a couple of 750-pound bombs on them and a rocket pod. And it would go out, and it would attack targets in Laos because it didn't have any range. And, you know, that was its mission. And the joke on the Sandy drivers, the A1E drivers, is that, you know, what are you taking up? Well, I'm taking up 6 750s and a pod of this and this thing and that thing, and then a 104 on each wing. the A1E drivers were just saying, you know, they could take whatever the 104 could take plus multiply times 10. I mean, that was just a fantastic aircraft. Mm-hmm. And so they were both being used in Laos, and the 104, you know, I can't imagine it was effective in that ground support role. But anyway, they would take off every day, and mm-hmm. we'd see them, and they'd go out and do their little mission, mm-hmm. And that was it. Except one day, and I don't remember if it was late 66 or early 67, a 104 was, you know, that wasn't what it was built for, that type of mission, by the way. And so I'm assuming they had jerry-rigged some of the armaments and the electronics to handle that mission. Mm-hmm. And one day it's sitting at the end of the runway, ready to take off, and there's a crewman there, or ground crew, arming the plane right before it took off. And as soon as he armed it, it had a rocket pod on it, and it launched the rockets across the base.
Oh.
Now, here we were in our operations building. The operations building consisted of the two operations centers for the two squadrons, plus the debrief area, intelligence area, conference room, you know, and some other facilities like that. And all of a sudden, we hear an explosion, and it made a direct hit on the generator for our building, which was about 50 feet from our building. It hit the generator. So we hear an explosion, and the lights go out, and we think we're under a rocket attack. And so we all go running out of the building. Well, these rockets skipped along the ground, and then they explode, and one went out of the base and hit a Thai village and killed a baby, I heard. I mean, this is all secondhand information, and injured some other people. But there was an Air Force major who was injured and had to be air-evac'd out of there. He was seriously injured from the one hit. We figured that the rocket had to skip around our building or skip somewhere because a direct line from the 104 to where it hit went through our building, so it was skipping along the ground and got deflected. So, you know, that was the one rocket attack, the one combat experience, so to speak, I had in my 1 year at UDorn.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting side note about it, and again, I had written this down,
mm-hmm.
is we had these bunkers all over the base, and the rumor was that there were cobras living in the bunkers. Now, I never, my whole year there, not only didn't see a cobra, I didn't even know if cobras actually existed in UDorn. I never heard of it, but the rumor was that cobras lived in those bunkers. So, as far as we know, this was an actual rocket attack. We didn't know it was one of our own planes. Everyone, all these well-educated Air Force personnel come running out of that building, and not a single person went into the bunker. Everyone just stayed outside, just got out of the building, and you look around, and we were all just kind of sitting down outside waiting for to see what else would happen.
Uh-huh.
Not a single person went into the bunkers. And again, as far as we knew, this was a real attack. So some of the stories and rumors. Never did see a cobra. But, yeah. They said it was in a bunker. I was going to believe them.
Yeah. How about other wildlife? Other problems with insects,
ants,
spiders, stuff
ants.
Like that?
You know, I lived in a hooch, uh-huh. House off base. And oh, I remember one time being woken up by ants in my bed biting me. Bugs, yeah. I never saw any snakes. I don't remember seeing any snakes. No wildlife. I mean, there were water buffalo for mm-hmm. the meat. You get a T-bone steak at the local restaurant, it was water buffalo T-bone,
uh-huh.
which means it was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Insects were the only things I remembered,
okay.
particularly ants biting me.
Did you have to take malaria pills there?
Oh, yeah, once a week. I took everything.
Mm-hmm.
You had to take a GG shot for hepatitis and malaria pills once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mess around. Some people skipped their malaria pills. Mm-hmm. They were sitting in bottles at the officers' club and all around. I mean, it was an honor system. And to me, if you didn't do it, you were stupid. And the same thing with the GG shot. Some people maneuvered it so they only had to do one their whole tour. I had two or three, you know, because it hurt. It was painful. But I wasn't going to mess around with that. Took it as soon as I got there, and then the minimum time, I think, was 5 months. I took it again.
Mm-hmm.
Probably took it again right before I left.
Mm.
Yeah.
So
there were people that tried to maneuver around taking their malaria pill. Those are the only thing special I remember,
mm-hmm.
malaria pills and GG shot for hepatitis. I can't remember the medical term. It's like lumenglobin or something like that,
mm-hmm.
whatever that medical term was.
Did you get sick at all while you were there?
No.
Any serious?
The only thing I ever remember was getting infections on my arm and going in and getting penicillin pills. That sounds incriminating, but it was strictly infections on my arm. And the penicillin cleared that up.
What do you mean it sounds incriminating?
Taking penicillin for infection. Yeah, but that was the only time I remember getting sick.
Okay.
I worked out every day. Mm-hmm. We had great facilities. We were in Thailand. We were at Udorn, the biggest base probably, or one of the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
In 67, they started putting a lot of money into Udorn. Bob Hope showed up.
Mm.
I was impressed with his visit.
Okay. What do you remember about it?
It was 100%. He put on a USO show, and it was being filmed. So, you know, I got an insight into it. I had seen some of his other shows later on television, so I knew how they did it. And, you know, if he put on 10 shows, they just showed different excerpts from each of the shows. You know, there were all the people. What's her name? Red hair actress. Can't remember her name, but anyway. She's still around. Anyway, he put on a first-class show. You know, brought all the pretty women and the band and good humor. And what which also impressed me about Bob Hope is they sent an advance team into the base and they found out all the stories on the base. So when he came in, he was telling jokes that were geared toward that base.
Wow!
Like one of the jokes was, and I remember this one was about the roast beef and the chow hall.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a couple of jokes about roast beef in the chow hall. And
that's cool.
I mean, when I heard those jokes, mm-hmm. I knew that he was coming in. Unless that was the problem in every chow hall in mm-hmm. Southeast Asia, I don't know, but I doubt it. Because, their advance team obviously had good information, and he was able to tailor the jokes and get better humor.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really impressed with it.
Yeah.
It was first class.
Were you referring to Ann Margaret?
Ann Margaret, exactly, yeah. I think I put that in the... Did I write that down?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, but yeah, it was Ann Margaret.
Okay.
Yeah.
I knew that she was on some of the circuits.
So yeah, and then there was Miss whatever. You know, they always had a Miss something or other.
Okay.
Yeah. And a band and mm-hmm. a comedian, Bob Hope mainly, and mm-hmm. a singer and things like that.
Yeah.
So they put money into there was a U.S. show, but they, as I mentioned yesterday, they had tennis court and swimming pool and
mm-hmm.
and they built couple of handball courts, and I was a handball fanatic. So it worked out every day.
Mm-hmm.
Kept healthy that way.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation, bought a Honda 90 motorcycle, and that's how I got to and from the base.
And your quarters off base, what were they like?
They were nice, except for the lack during the dry season, you didn't have any water, so I would shower on base. I would shower and shave on base because during the dry season, which was a good 6 months, there was no water. And actually, the wet season was relatively dry, so off-base, the water situation was bad. But, that didn't matter. The place was, I didn't eat there. I always ate either in town or on base. I never prepared a meal at our hooch. There were three of us sharing it, so we just used it for sleeping. Didn't socialize there. We went home, slept, and came back to base. And so, everything was tied to the base. And so, including my showers and shaving and everything else.
So, when you ate off base, were you eating at
the local restaurants?
Local restaurants that served Thai food or American food?
No, Thai food. Although you could always get a steak. But I remember one of the best meals. A bunch of us went out to a Chinese restaurant, Thai restaurant. Thai food is a variation on Chinese food. And we went out, and there were, I don't know how many of us, 10 of us, and we just said, bring us food, and they just brought us food. And then at the end, they said, that's enough. And at the end, they divided it, told us what the cost was, and so it was a few dollars each, and that was it. That was a great way to eat, so I ate out a lot, but also the officers' club was a good place to eat. So it was mainly Thai food, but you could get your steak, but in Udorn, I think the steak was water buffalo. When you got down to Bangkok, then you could get the good quality steak, including Kobe beef. That was important. That was the most expensive thing you could buy in Bangkok would be Kobe beef.
Okay. Now, on base,
yeah.
Could you get, at the officers' club, could you get a good American steak?
you could get a steak, and I really don't. I'm assuming it was Australian meat. I'm assuming they imported it from Australia, but I don't know. I just remember the steaks were decent, and where it came from, I don't know. So the fact that it was decent, we didn't complain about it, makes me think it wasn't water buffalo.
Okay.
Because the water buffalo used to sit out in the sun all day long.
Ugh. I guess that's one way to cure it.
Yeah.
Did you have to pay at the officers' club, or was that free for Air Force officers like
yourself? Oh no. I mean, you mean dues? Are you talking about dues?
Well, dues, and also for the food that you eat.
Oh yeah, the food and the meals. I mean, we weren't on. This wasn't. They didn't have. They had the chow hall for the enlisted, and then they had the officers' club for us. But we had to pay. Yeah. I'm assuming we even had dues each month, but I don't know. Our whole life was there, so I'm betting that it was a profitable enterprise.
And?
I mean, that's where every breakfast I ever ate for the year I was in Thailand, I ate at the officers' club.
Okay.
Never ate breakfast downtown.
Now, did you interact very much with the Thai people?
Not much. Not much at all. I mean, I taught one term for the University of Maryland, and I did it in an off-base facility, and there was a Peace Corps guy there, and I remember meeting some Thais, but that was about it. My work was entirely with Americans, didn't have any contact with Thais, and my hooch was just for sleeping, and then we'd go to a restaurant. So for the year there, I had no contact with Thais. I mean, friendly, or I mean, they were all friendly. I mean, I didn't have any friends who were Thais. I didn't have any non-military contacts, and I think that was generally true with just about everyone.
Okay. Were you ever briefed on rules for interacting with the local population?
I don't ever remember. I don't think there were any rules. Show good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever remember there being any rules about contact with Thais, such as warnings or don't do this or don't. No, there was nothing.
Right. Okay. How about warnings or rumors about what might happen to you if you frequent, say, a house of ill repute or something like that?
Well, I mean, everyone knew about the VD rate and stuff like that. But again, I don't remember. And, that was the only thing, is just warnings generally about watch out for that. But there was nothing specific about that. And I remember, I had a motorcycle, and a buddy of mine who was a pilot had a motorcycle, and we went up the road 30 miles to the Laotian border. We went up to the Mekong River, just drove our motorcycles up there. And now we weren't allowed to cross the river into Laos, which is a shame, because I would have loved to have gone to Vientiane. But we were told, that was the only thing I was told, actually. We were told specifically we could not go to Laos. And that's the only thing I ever remember being told.
Did they tell you why?
It was, they said, too dangerous. Now, whether or not it was, reading that book again, at that time it probably wasn't, but I was certainly going to believe them on that one.
Right. Yeah, because, of course, Air America families were living in Vientiane.
Right. Yeah.
Lots of Americans were just walking around the city and living there. And
although I've been known to abuse rules, I didn't abuse that one.
Yeah.
I just, played cautious on that one. But we were willing to drive up to the Mekong River and drive around there or ride around there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wanted to see it.
On those types of trips or when you were in town and things like that, how were you received by the local population?
Everything was very friendly. I just remember 100% friendly. Now, you had to watch out. I mean, kids would try and steal things. We all had motorcycles for getting to and from the hooch. And what we did is when we came home at night, or during the day, whenever we worked, we would bring the motorcycles inside the building and lock it up. Lock the motorcycle and lock the building from the inside just to make sure. Because people would steal things, but that was how some of the kids made money. But as far as the people, I just remember them 100% friendly for the whole year there.
Okay.
Whether you met them on the street, in the shops I frequented, or the restaurants, when I first got there, I stayed at the local hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was like a BAQ. The motorcycle shop to take care of the motorcycle where I bought it and then where I had it serviced. Any other? There were a couple of clothing stores in town. They were run by Indians, and they were very friendly, too, because they were making a lot of money, too. I guess everyone was making a lot of money off of the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Now, you mentioned earlier that some of the Twixes you received concerned information from other places, like what happened in the Middle East. What about information and intelligence coming from Vietnam to New York?
It all came from 7th Air Force, and the only thing they would send to us is what we needed, which was the big three again, AAA missiles and MiG. So whenever they had any intelligence, they would send it. And there was they put out you'd almost call it like a magazine. They put out something on flying technique or just tactic. That's what it was. It was like a tactics magazine that came out of 7th Air Force. Obviously, it was classified secret. And I remember writing an article for that on tactics, recce tactics. And, we got there, they were at medium level, and then they went to high level, and then they went down to medium. They tried an experiment with low level, which was a disaster. Recce should not be flying at low level for that type of strategic targets. And I remember writing an article about it, and at that particular point, I can't remember where the tactics were, but let's just say it was medium level. So I wrote an article saying, medium level. By the time it came out, we were back to high level. Or I wrote saying high level. By the time it came out, we were back to medium level. But we were in our unit, we'd be the only one reading that. Anyway, that part. But I remember writing an article and sending it down, and they published it
mm-hmm.
on recce tactics, flying tactics.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, I don't know if anyone saved that at Maxwell Air Force Base, but that would be an interesting set of documents. If
yes,
anyone
sir.
Did save it.
Mm-hmm. We can hope.
Yeah.
Let's see. Why do you think they chose to fit the RF-4 and the one? Is it 101 or 101?
101.
Yeah, the 101. With camera equipment for recce missions, instead of just deploying more aircraft like the U-2, which was specifically designed for that type of operation.
Yeah. Now, the U-2, what I'm guessing is we know the U-2 was effective at 60,000 feet. The U-2 could not see a golf ball, similar to satellites today. And I'm guessing that we know the U-2 was effective on missile sites. When you look at leading to the 1960 incident when Powers was shot down,
mm-hmm.
It was looking at missile sites and it was looking at fields and runways. I think the two things, I'm guessing. One is they didn't have enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
We did have some U-2 photography, and I think they used some of it for... I vaguely remember, it could have been satellite photography, high level for weather.
Mm.
Maybe that was satellite. Did they have satellites in 66, 67 for weather recce? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
But I'm thinking just the reaction time
mm.
that our crews were going out every day and they were flying specifically, looking at a bridge over a river,
mm.
looking at a thermal power plant, looking at this site, that site,
mm-hmm.
and, pinpoint. Whereas the U-2, just like I was telling you, we were looking at the coast of China inland 100 miles, and that was for a broad sweep of a 1,000-mile area,
mm-hmm.
or a 1,000-mile run, let's say,
mm.
or maybe that's too far, maybe a 500-mile run. So I don't think even though I'm talking about strategic targets, we know there weren't a lot of strategic targets in North Vietnam, and,
mm-hmm.
and really what we were doing is it was tactical reconnaissance,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think the U-2 was made for tactical reconnaissance.
Okay. There's a shorter duration mission.
Yeah,
basically.
Ours was.
Yeah. Okay. And, same.
Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't have U-2s there, but I wouldn't have known about it.
Mm-hmm.
Since it was still a very classified weapon system.
Right.
Or reconnaissance system.
Let's see. Well, was there anything else about
No, I think
operations?
Your questions have been extensive, forcing me to really think back, and I appreciate that. It's amazing what I do remember. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I remember it accurately.
Okay. Let's see. Oh, were there any, I don't know if it was allowed or if people could accomplish it surreptitiously. Did anybody bring their wives or their families over to live in Thailand that you knew of?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, digging deep, maybe one person.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, I mean, obviously Air America is a different story.
Right, yeah. Right, but I'm talking about the Air Force.
Yeah, Air Force.
Personnel you served with.
You know, when we went, when we deployed with 50 of us,
uh-huh.
and we're talking 50 officers,
mm-hmm.
not a single one brought their wife with them.
Okay.
And I say maybe one. I mean, we're talking thousands of people. If there mm-hmm. was one, I just don't remember seeing them at the club. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have seen them at the club.
Yeah.
They've been officers. And, I mean, it's possible, but...
Were there any rules against it?
Well, I'm sure there were.
Yeah.
But then what it would have meant is that you would have been there in a tourist... Yes. I just remembered something.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for digging. Yeah, one or two people did. And the reason I all of a sudden remember it is because they were there on a tourist visa.
Mm-hmm.
And what they had to do is every so many months, go up to Laos, leave Thailand, go to Laos, and then come back into Thailand
okay.
to extend their tourist visa.
Okay.
I remember a couple of people talking about that their wives were going to go up to Laos so they could stay there longer. So that, yes, they were allowed to be there, but of course it would be at their own expense,
yes.
and they would have to be on a, you know, my wife went with me and kids to Germany, you know, obviously she had a military passport, she was a, you know, full status and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I mean, they wouldn't have had, unless they could have worked something out, they wouldn't have had access to the clubs, to the BX, places like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they would have done for medical treatment. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they would have had access to that.
Yeah.
Of course, considering that they took me out on a flight, an RF-4C over Vietnam and Laos, I'm sure people would have turned a blind eye if someone needed some medical care.
Yes.
Yeah, that would have been a minor problem,
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing.
Okay. How would you evaluate the, you mentioned that there were good recreational facilities. How about
yeah.
the other facilities, like the medical facilities, things like that?
Yeah, I only used the hospital once, but I don't remember anyone complaining about it. There seemed to be enough medical care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember people complaining about the BX or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think people were happy to be at UDORN because of the facilities.
Yeah. Was there a good library there, too?
There was a good audio music hobby shop.
Mm-hmm.
Library, I'm assuming there was one, but I don't remember it was good. I mean, that was the thing I do. I do a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be over there listening to music at the hobby shop
mm-hmm.
reading.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I don't remember having a shortage of books.
Okay.
But I don't remember a library per se.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I didn't have a problem finding stuff to read.
Yeah.
You know, probably an indicator that they did have a facility there.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you correspond very much with people back home?
Well, that was the only communications you had.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-email, pre-good phone system. The
right.
only way you could do it is to write.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did, basically, write to my family. And it would take forever for the mail to get there.
Mm-hmm. Did your principal correspondents were your parents?
Right. Yeah.
Did they write very much about things that were happening in the U.S. as far as?
No, I got that from Time and Newsweek.
Okay.
I remember reading Time and Newsweek when I was there. My parents would not have expressed or written political things.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask you about your opinion of American leadership while you were there. What did you think about the officers that were running things in Thailand and UDORN that you were, you know, worked under?
Well, I was impressed with the leadership at the wing and the squadrons and all that.
Mm-hmm.
What we never really felt impressed with, and this is conversations with the crews mm-hmm. also was the leadership down at Tansanute at 7th mm-hmm. Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, you know, what are they doing? Don't they know what's going on? You know, they were hundreds and hundreds of miles away,
mm-hmm.
more than hundreds. I don't know how many miles it is from Udorn to Saigon,
mm-hmm.
but a long distance.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, we always felt that they didn't really know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had these JCS targets, which meant that they were approved by Johnson and the JCS. And, you know, a swinging bamboo bridge, that's exaggerated, but a swinging bamboo bridge might have a JCS number on it. And we're thinking, you know, this war has gotten out of hand. It's, you know, when the JCS is control and the president controlling minor targets. And the other criticism, as I said, was over 7th Air Force. It was run by Momeyer, and I don't know if everyone called him this, but it was ATC Momeyer. He had come out of training command,
mm-hmm.
and it was sort of like he didn't really know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's unfair to him, but we were a long ways away and didn't feel like 7th Air Force really understood what we were doing.
Right.
But then, of course, they were under pressure from
mm-hmm.
JCS and
mm-hmm.
and the president, so maybe they were reacting to them.
You said ATC?
ATC, Air Training Command.
Okay.
He had come out of Air Training Command. Now,
okay.
He has a great operational
mm-hmm.
record, you know, from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of like, that's another way of saying Mickey Mouse.
Okay.
Air Force way of saying Mickey Mouse.
Okay. Now, what were the Mickey Mouse things that you remember most that came out of 7th Air Force?
That's a tough one. It was just, you know, flying certain missions and not realizing, you know, I'm really digging for this.
Mm-hmm.
Flying missions and not realizing what was going on with the defensive capabilities, you know, the routes in and out. The routes were dictated down at 7th Air Force because they had to be in conjunction with other missions going on.
Yes.
And particularly the deployment of tankers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they told us where the tankers were going to be, and we had to fly the mission in conjunction with the tankers.
Okay.
So it was, you know, one of the criticisms is flying the same routes all the time. That was a big criticism.
Yeah, predictability.
Pardon?
Predictability.
Yeah, predictability. Now, they would argue that, number one, they had the tankers there anyway, and the Vietnamese would have seen the tankers, so they knew where the route was. And then the other thing they would have argued is that they had the EB-66s, the electronic jammers.
Yeah.
And they would go up, and even though we were coming down a predictable route, they would be jamming the radar. And that's true. On the other hand, you know, so that took care of the SA-2s, but then you had the AAA.
Yes.
Yeah, that knew where you were coming in, and then they used the barrages.
And the MiG threat.
Yeah, and the MiG threat.
Hmm. Now, did this kind of thing trickle down the chain of, trickle up the chain of command? That is, the fact that as the pilots and other personnel actually engaging in these missions, this is what you thought, this is what you saw, you thought this was bad, poor judgment, poor tactics. Was there a mechanism by which that could go up the chain of command and maybe they could address it?
Well, in theory, I mean, the wing commander, you know, go from the squadron commander to the wing commander.
Right.
Now, this is all going on transparent to us.
Okay.
You know, I assume that that any concerns would go to the squadron commander and either through the DCO or the wing commander down the 7th Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was their job, and I assume they did voice it.
Yeah.
The objections.
Yeah.
And maybe they did make changes. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that part is kind of a little bit foreign to me.
Yeah.
Okay. But I just remember the table talk, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that 7th Air Force.
What about other aspects of the way the war was being fought? I mean, when you got there, and as your experience increased over time, and by the time you left. You know, when you left, did you think that we were winning, and did you think we were fighting in the right way?
Oh, I knew we weren't winning. When I left in October of 67, the way it was being fought, two things in particular, that universal criticism. One, all the restrictions on the bombing. You couldn't go here, you couldn't go there, you couldn't attack this target, you couldn't attack that target. And number two, some of the targeting was kind of ridiculous, and this is the term we use, the swinging bamboo bridges,
mm-hmm.
You know, which represented smaller targets, and you're sending a flight of of F-4Cs, each of them with, what, 650-pound bombs, going after this swinging bamboo bridge. Well, it was more than a swinging bamboo bridge, but you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have two recce birds going, taking pictures of it. It just, you know, seemed dumb. And, you know, it seemed like we were going nowhere.
Yeah.
And when I came back, and I went there, and I think I told you yesterday, I went there saying, yeah, it was the right thing for us to do to be there. And when I came back, I said, no, this is, we're fighting the war the wrong way.
Mm.
And, you know, we got to stop this. You know, crap or get off the pot. Do it right or get out of there.
You mentioned in the questionnaire that when you were,
you went back to
Rutgers and addressed the ROTC cadets there.
Yeah, and so that was so that's why I can date it. It was October of 67. And I paid my courtesy call to the PAS,
mm-hmm.
Professor of Air Science, and
mm-hmm.
he said, well, why don't you come into the class and talk to our seniors?
Mm.
So I went down there, and the thing I remember most was saying, crap or get off the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't doing it right. You know, if we're not going to do it right, then get out.
Okay. Now, you said before you left and, you know, when you first arrived, you felt that the United States should be there.
Yeah, I remember, again, I said that I was a believer in the domino theory,
right.
You know, the containment, stop communism. I was looking at it from a European point of view,
mm-hmm.
draw the line,
right.
You know, good guys, bad guys, all that I absorbed and believed in.
Yeah. When you came back, did you think, I mean, I realize you thought that we should change our tactics if we're going to stay, but
right.
what about just the issue of staying? Did you think we should even stay there?
I came to an anti-war position from a different point of view of
okay.
the others that were saying it was an illegal and moral war. I was saying, we're not doing it right, let's get out.
Mm.
And then I was saying, you know, we're losing too many lives, it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American life, you know, losing a few friends over there, three in particular, you know, I said, it's not worth it, what we're doing, both the way we're fighting it and just then it, the principle of it.
Okay.
You know, we're not going to win it, so let's get out. Now, I still was a believer that, you know, we had to have a strong force in Europe. You know, I still believe that was a containment issue.
Mm-hmm.
And good guys, bad guys, but definitely get out. And I can remember going into class and even presenting an anti-war position. And I told you in 1970, when I marched in an anti-war rally in Denver,
mm-hmm.
down to 16th Street, when Vice President Agnew came to town. That probably was in June of 1970, give or take a month.
Okay.
You know, I was a believer in the war on poverty and Johnson's
mm-hmm.
Domestic policies, and here we were spending X billions of dollars a year overseas, killing a lot of Americans. It just wasn't worth it anymore.
Now, do you think you would have felt differently if you had come back thinking that we were fighting the war correctly?
Probably. With my state of mind then, I think, you know, if we had really going at it the right way, bombing the targets that we're supposed to, all out, trying to win it in the North and South, I probably would have felt that way. Now, in retrospect, the war was probably unwinnable from the start. So I don't know at what point I would have felt that we were winning it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is in retrospect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it was winnable.
Yeah. At the time, though, you know, trying to take yourself back to when you came back in 1967. Of course, some of the bombing restrictions had to do with humanitarian concerns. That is, you know, hitting certain dikes, hitting targets that were adjacent to or in the midst of civilian populated areas.
Right.
I mean, we didn't. This is actually the time period when we're just introducing precision guided munitions.
Well, actually, this is before.
Well, yeah, but
yeah.
They're starting to come into being in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, but I mean, when I was there, it was before they had that.
Right.
So you had this F-4C with 6 750s,
mm-hmm.
and
they're just gravity bombs.
Right, and you know, so the guy's doing a dive to the ground, and
mm-hmm.
as you know, everyone's firing everything they can at him.
Mm-hmm.
And the odds of hitting the target, whether it was Vietnam or World War II, was, you know, it's kind of slim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you sent a whole flight out of it, because, you know, if you have 4 times 6 750s, you have a better chance, and you're going to have a lot of collateral damage.
Yes. So I guess in the context of the Second World War, where we're fighting a total war, unlimited war, It's because we're fighting basically for survival. But this is a different type of war. Limited war in support of Cold War policy. We're not in an immediate, in a direct threat. That is, Vietnam is not attacking the United States. The political considerations that the Johnson administration and the Nixon administration had to take into account to minimize collateral damage for political reasons, was that discussed much amongst the pilots? That, you know, the, there were restrictions, but there were potentially some very realistic political concerns there.
Yeah, generally speaking, we all thought they were dumb restrictions.
Okay.
Generally speaking, the table talk, the consensus with these were dumb restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, in 2020 historical hindsight, looking back on it, to me, the number one lesson of Vietnam is you do it right or you don't do it at all.
Okay.
And we went into the Gulf War doing it right, and we went into Afghanistan doing it right, and which meant that in both wars we had to take a certain amount of collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a warmonger, but if, you know, that's part of doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to fight the war, you do it right, or if you're worried about collateral damage and image and all that, then that's not your war. You pick another one, or you don't pick any.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't mess around.
Okay. Well, when you got back here to the U.S., first, what was the trip like back?
Long airplane flight in a 707.
Okay.
I mean, anxious to get back. I remember landing in California, whether I landed at Travis or San Francisco, I don't remember. Probably Travis, and then going over to the San Francisco airport and then catching a flight to probably to Kennedy at that point, Newark or Kennedy, and my parents picking me up. And I spent about 3 weeks in New Jersey and then drove across country, bought a car, drove across country to my new assignment, which was teaching history at the Air Force Academy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was, again, I mentioned this in the questionnaire, for my arrival in the States, 67, there was no problem. Hawthorne was a conservative town. I come into Colorado Springs, a very conservative town, signed at the Air Force Academy. So, you know, I never, ever experienced any kind of anti-war feeling directed at me. I was never called a warmonger. I mean, I was in the Air Force. I stayed in the Air Force. I had short hair during the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
When I went through airborne training in 68, I had even shorter hair. You know, they just about shaved it off.
Mm-hmm.
I never experienced anything.
Mm-hmm. When you went on campus to talk to that ROTC group and you visited Rutgers, what was the atmosphere like there? And I assume you went in uniform.
No.
Or you didn't?
I don't remember being in uniform.
Okay.
So, you know, I went to the history department, I went to ROTC, and looked up, went to the gym, you know, things like that, just to look at the fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went to the fraternity, introduced myself, probably had lunch at the fraternity. I'd graduated, told them I'd graduated in 62. This was 67. I was welcomed. Never, same thing. You know, very positive there.
Mm-hmm. And was there any anti-war activity that you saw?
Never remember seeing any at Rutgers.
Okay.
Now, maybe a year or two later it would have been different.
Mm-hmm.
This is still relatively early. This is late 67.
Right. Okay. When did you start moving across country to go to Colorado?
Oh, later in October.
Okay, so it's still late 67.
Yeah.
When did you arrive?
I think I took about 3 weeks of leave and then drove across country. So, I mean, we're talking basically the month of October, leaving Vietnam and reporting to Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm. And so you arrived sometime in November?
Yeah, the last week of October, first week in November,
Let's see. Well, during your first months there, and going into January of 68, what do you remember about hearing what was going on in Vietnam, and what do you remember most about learning at first about Tet?
Now this we've been running long, and I wonder if we can keep...
Let me go ahead and put an ending on this real quick.
Yeah, and then we can come back to that if you want.
This will end the interview with Alan Osier on the 20th. Thank you, sir. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Alan Osier on the 21st of February 2002 at approximately 2 o'clock Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Alan Osier is in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with a quick discussion of what things were like in terms of what you remember about key events after you got back in 1967, in particular the Tet Offensive of 1968.
Yeah. Well, I had mentioned before that in October when I came back, I was disillusioned with the way things were going. And then and I remember very vividly when Tet happened, I was really sucked into the media part of it, that it looked like this was the end and, you know, why bother? I mean, so that's late January, February. And it was sort of a 1-2 punch with me as far as my attitude change.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a combination of Tet and then in April when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Mm.
And it was sort of like, and then all the riots that took place.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made me think more and more that, you know, we're just squandering money over there. You know, why bother? And again, it goes back to my original point that, you know, we're not fighting it correctly anyway.
Yes, sir.
We're not fighting it to win.
Mm-hmm.
So why spend all the money and then all the American lives that were being lost? So it was a combination of those two events that had a big influence on my
mm-hmm.
life.
Now, when you were teaching at the Air Force Academy,
yeah.
And you were teaching history, what courses were you teaching, and how did they touch upon the Vietnam War? How did you incorporate what your experiences and your knowledge of the Vietnam War into those?
Well, first of all, when you teach history at the Academy, whether it was then or now, it's very easy and appropriate to go off in any direction that's relevant to the
mm-hmm.
cadets.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vietnam War back in 68 and 69 and 70 was certainly very relevant to the cadets.
Yes,
so, I mean, as it turned out, I was teaching world history, American history, and military history.
Okay.
And, there was no problem at all bringing up the issue of the Vietnam War. I mean, that was the central issue, the central thing that was discussed most in the class and out of the class. And I remember, again, just bringing up what I would call anti-war views and having discussions in the class, and no one thought twice about it. In other words, there was relative academic freedom. You know, it depended. Obviously, you had to show good form in the sense that, there's a time and a place for everything. There were some ground rules at the academy, the honor system, and, some other things that related to it that obviously you would support, and I would certainly want to support. But as far as the views on the Vietnam War, I mean, I took an anti-war position. I mean, I wasn't carrying a Vietnamese, I'm exaggerating for effect, obviously, but I wasn't carrying a Vietnamese flag, or I wasn't carrying a banner or a sign saying, U.S. out of Vietnam down the halls, but I was just very quietly discussing it in classroom. And a friend of mine who lives in Denver was a book salesman. We had then he worked for Prentice Hall, and we had bought a couple of books from him for the American History course.
Mm-hmm.
And I invited him into one of my classrooms. And a year ago, when I bumped into Jerry again, he commented that just how amazed he was that I could go into the class and speak out against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just really surprised.
You mentioned that in the questionnaire that this upset a number of your students.
Well, yeah, it did.
What was their response to your personal experience? And obviously, you predicated your opinion on some of your experience and observations. What was their response to that?
I mean, you had the full spectrum in the classroom. You know, some people listening respectfully,
right.
and maybe either at some level going along with what I'm saying, and then
mm-hmm.
others saying, arguing with me in class or just strongly disagreeing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one cadet, and he would have graduated about 70. And I remember talking to him one time, and he had a different view.
Mm-hmm.
He was worried that the war might be over before he gets over there.
Mm-hmm.
His view was, he was going to pilot training, and he wanted to participate in the Vietnam War
mm-hmm.
From the point of view of a pilot. So there were all sorts of
yeah.
views.
But
most of them were, though, positive.
Mm-hmm.
Toward our involvement in the war.
Mm-hmm. Was there any concern on the part of the cadets that if the war ended too quickly, then obviously when they did become commissioned aviators or Air Force officers, they would be at a disadvantage because all these other career officers would have combat experience. They
mm-hmm.
wouldn't, and that would, of course, affect promotions and things like that.
Well, the problem is I only remember ever having that discussion with one cadet.
Oh, okay.
And you can't generalize based on that one.
Yeah.
I mean, he just happened to feel that way, but mm-hmm. it's possible then there were 100 others who didn't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really generalize about that.
Yeah. Okay. You also mentioned in the questionnaire that there was a speech by Lewis Lomax at Colorado College that helped you put things in perspective, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit more.
Colorado College is has a strong, it's a good college, mm-hmm. and has a very good distinguished speakers program back then and now, where they bring in leading people from around the world. And Lewis Lomax was a civil rights leader. I think he was from Arizona. And he wrote a book called, I think it was called The Negro Revolt, around 1967. And right after King was assassinated, he went down there. I went to a number of lectures down at Colorado College. And he talked about King, and he talked about the war, and I remember he talked about King's objection to the war. And I remember he also talked about black power and the amount of money that was needed that was going into the, you know, sort of basically the position I had, that the amount of money that was going into the war versus mm-hmm. what could be used on the domestic front.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of ideas going through my mind, and he just kind of put it in perspective. He, in a sense, gave me clarity,
mm-hmm.
I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that had had a great impact on me,
mm-hmm.
that one particular speech. And so that was either in April or May of 68.
And it was, I guess it was just shortly, within 2 years, I guess, of you getting back, that you did go ahead and participate in an anti-war protest.
Yeah, probably shouldn't have. I mean, that would have been, that actually was dumb, since I was a career officer and was planning to stay in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think about it in retrospect, I'm glad I survived it, and no one saw me, or though I must be on some Army. I think the Army taped all those protests, CID,
mm-hmm.
so I'm probably on a tape somewhere or filmed it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look back at it, that was really a stupid thing to do. That went over the line.
Well,
that would have ended things right there, and as far as my career in the Air Force.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean that's different.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm projecting back. Don't forget. I'm not talking
about
today.
Right.
I'm projecting back to 1970 when I did that. And again,
mm-hmm.
it was around June. It was after Kent State.
Mm-hmm.
And when Agnew, we could look up in the Denver Post, find out when Agnew came to town or something like that.
Yeah.
That is beyond the pale.
Well, given the open nature and the academic freedom that you had in the classroom to take that kind of a position. Were you ever talked to about it by anybody in the chain of command of the Air Force Academy?
No.
That
was different. That was in the classroom. And I could have free and open discussions in the classroom as long as I also kept to the material that I was supposed to cover and prepared the cadets. But this was different. This was outside. This was public.
Mm-hmm.
But
you weren't in uniform.
No, of course not. If I had been, that would have been...
Right.
Then I would have been known very quickly.
Yes. Okay. At the time, did you feel uncomfortable, strange in that environment?
Huh.
Or did you feel at ease at home?
Probably none of the above. Probably something in between.
Okay.
I'm sure, I don't remember specifically, but I'm sure it would have been an awkward experience, yet it would have been, I would have thought it would have been okay.
Yeah.
Probably something in between.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard one to answer.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember it being exciting
mm-hmm.
and interesting, and just seeing the people who participated, were just average Mary and Joe American.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're not talking about any kind of stereotypes of anti-war people. We're talking about average Americans participating in that one.
Yeah.
And what prompted the protest was a visit of Agnew, who was the vice president, which meant he was the assistant commander-in-chief, so to speak.
Right.
So that's what kind of would have put it also over the pale
outside
of it.
What did you think of the arrival of of President Nixon and his plan to withdraw the United States, a peace with honor, the Vietnamization.
I had a lot of suspicions about him. And, I mean, he did, you know, obviously from 69 through 72, American troops were pulled out. And I just, I did have, you know, I knew, you know, I went through airborne training in 68, and I knew that we had operations in Cambodia. I remember talking to a pilot and when I was at UDORN, and, you know, he had been involved in operations on the ground in North Vietnam, so I knew we were playing hanky-panky in North Vietnam. I knew what Air America was doing, and it, you know, I just, and Nixon, now that was all before Nixon, but still, I just, I guess the Tricky Dick stereotype got to me, so I was kind of suspicious of him. I just didn't trust him.
What were the nature of the ground operations you learned of in North Vietnam?
Well, I was talking to a crew member one time. He was, I can't remember, I think he was 101, but it could have been, you know, 4C. I don't remember which one. And we were looking at a map of North Vietnam, and we were just kind of standing there very casually. I don't think I was briefing or debriefing him. I think we were just standing there chatting, and there was a map of North Vietnam. And he pointed at Vin, and he said, "I was there." I said, "What?" You know, this is in probably in 66. He said, "Yeah, I was there." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, I was part of a team that went in there with, and I can't remember if he was with the Special Forces or who he was with, but he was, I think they were I think he said he was parachuted in there because he broke his leg on the landing, and they had to air evac him out of there. So he was in there for a very short time. But he, you know, commented. And then I have read that we had clandestine operations in North Vietnam early on, where I guess we were, you know, I don't know if we were trying to sabotage or propaganda, but we did have operations in North Vietnam.
Okay. What did you think when you learned of the Paris Peace Accords in 1973?
I mean, that was very positive. I mean, finally it was ending, and I knew, I guess as everyone did, that the promises made to South Vietnam were just a gimmick to get out of there. You know, I think hardly anyone would have believed that we were going to continue to support the South Vietnamese government. It was just a way of getting out there, and especially to bring home our POWs. Now, I was back, then I was at Patrick Air Force Base.
Okay.
And when I came back to the academy in December of 75, I met a POW who was released as a result of that. We became friends. And he was assigned to the Air Force Academy.
Okay. And so what went through your mind when Saigon fell in April 1975?
Sad. I mean, everyone's seen that last photograph of the helicopter on top of the, was that on top of the embassy building, and pulling away, and there are people trying to clamber up there, and you know, ultimately, for me personally, it was sad because I'd spent a year there. I knew people had been killed. I knew that there were 50,000 Americans who had died over there for a cause. I had the whole POW experience, and then, you know, the country just literally collapsed. Which it did. I mean, the spring offensive, what was that, in April of 75? And the spring offensive was only a month or two before that. I mean, it very quickly collapsed. So my feeling was one of sadness. And then you know, it continued. You know, you had the incident with the ship right after that. And it just seemed to be poorly handled. The Iranian hostage situation. And that seemed to be poorly handled, especially when they sent in that force, and you know what happened there. So, you know, the country was really, I think the country was really down for most of the 70s. You know, from, and then before that, you had the resignation in, that would have been in August of 74, of Richard Nixon. Yeah. So you go from August of 74 to April of 75, and then the ship incident off of Cambodia. What the issue right after that is whether or not we're going to send troops into Angola, and we don't. and then into the Iranian hostage situation in 79. So, you know, from 74 to about 80, things were not good.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was, I don't know if you're young enough to remember that, or old enough, excuse me, if you're old enough to remember that, but that wasn't the, you know, psychologically, I think the country really was down.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, do you think it was worth it, what we did in Vietnam?
Oh, no. I mean, that's the real sadness, as I said in April of 75 when it fell,
mm.
is that it wasn't worth the 50,000 American lives. You know, it just wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And plus all the other lives that were affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you do it right or you don't do it at all, and
yeah.
we just kept lingering and lingering and lingering, and it wasn't a World War II situation where we had to fight every inch of the way and we were making progress and the cause seemed to be good.
Mm-hmm.
I said that, you know, during the time I thought the cause was good, but it wasn't worth it the way we were doing it and the way we squandered lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sending people out into the rice paddies and sending our air crews after those, again, the symbol for me, the swinging of bamboo bridges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just wasn't worth it.
Okay. What do you think we should take away from that experience?
Do it right. And that's what I had said yesterday or
yeah.
whenever we talked. That the Gulf War, although, you know, we're still dealing with one aspect of it, and that is Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
But still, we basically, from a military point of view, we did it right. Afghanistan, I really believe we're doing it correctly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did you take away from it personally that was most important for you?
It's hard to say if this would have happened anyway, because you don't know your development.
Mm-hmm.
But for me personally, I became a liberal Democrat. Okay, what does that mean? You know, just being a liberal Democrat is not the end all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not what I took away from it.
Mm-hmm.
What I took away from it that for me being a liberal Democrat means is more of a humanitarian approach
mm-hmm.
to American society, to helping people.
Mm-hmm.
I believed in what Johnson was doing in the war on poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And its ideas of the great society, and that was the sadness too, that it all was squandered because of the emphasis was on Vietnam rather than domestic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me it made me think about other people, race relations, human relations. In the Air Force, my major career field was human relations and race relations. I taught at the Defense Race Relations Institute. When I was at the academy, I was involved with their human relations programs. I was chief of social actions at Ramstein. I've written a book on black history, blacks in the Army, Air Forces during World War II, the problem of race relations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and last night I was conducting diversity training for the local Colorado Springs Police Department.
Okay.
In one of my voluntary activities. And diversity training really is human relations training under a different name.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, for me personally, that's what it did to me.
Okay. What do you think about the current U.S. position and policies towards Vietnam?
I think it's good to open it up, and we're doing it, and I think it was good that we did it on a gradual basis.
Mm-hmm.
And now, is it a full ambassador? I can't remember at this point.
That the U.S. has in Vietnam?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
That was the change. In other words, originally it was a, whatever the term.
Consulate.
What? The
oh,
consulate.
Yeah,
yeah,
it
and
was
then,
a consulate.
I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
The war's over. I think a lot of people realize that they were not not democratic liberators.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that everyone knows. And their society is not the kind of society that I would want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not about to go and criticize them.
Yes,
because if I criticize them, I have to criticize probably about 75 other countries in the world that have similar type governments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my beliefs is, people get all upset about the Chinese. Okay, if you're going to get upset about the Chinese government, then get upset about the other 75.
Mm-hmm.
Or shut up. Don't pick on the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the things they're doing are not good, but they're no better or no worse than many others.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so that's kind of the way I look at it.
Okay. And
again, on the one of the questions you did ask on the questionnaire was, would I want to go back there?
Mm-hmm.
If I were in the area, but I don't plan to be in the area, I like going to Europe. Okay. I mean, I have no emotional attachment to go back there or Thailand. I mean, it would be nice to see Saigon again and compare it in my mind and go back to Thailand. It would be nice to see Bangkok and Udorn and Pattaya Beach and all that. But, I mean, I'm not going to go out of my way to do it.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
One other thing about I just thought of when I was talking about the attitude during the 70s.
Yes, sir.
You know, I was a staunch Democrat. I did not like Richard Nixon at all. But I think one of the most important thing that President Ford did during his administration, and he sacrificed himself doing it, was to pardon Richard Nixon. I read in the, you know, I teach history at Regis University, and one of the textbooks I was using, it presented that incident in sort of a critical light, you know, subtly, but still critically. And I made a comment to the class. I said, you know, I was around then, and I said, this is wrong. The last thing the country needed was a trial of the ex-president, of a trial of Richard Nixon for any crimes he had committed. That absolutely was the last thing the country needed. And what Ford did, it was sort of like, wow, good, now we can get that behind us and move on. Because if he had not done that, and Nixon had gone to trial, I think it just would have deepened the depression, the psychological depression that Americans had at that time. And history books might continue to present that as, you know, critical of Ford, but they, you know, generally they're going to be written by historians that didn't live during that period and probably read some of the editorial comments that said, oh, that was the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But to live through that period, you know, to me it was very definitely the right thing to do.
Yes, sir. Okay. Anything else?
Boy, I can't think. You've asked 101 questions, 1,001 questions.
And I really appreciate your time.
No, okay. I appreciate this opportunity.
All right, well, let me put an ending on this officially. This
okay.
will end the interview. Thank you very much.